1975, work session on the following bills, 1825, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, 1865, HB 3274, separate dump file. HB 3275, name change. SB 604, public employee relations board. SB 947, crime notification board. SB 948, National Guard Museum. HB 5560, Capital Planning Commission. SB 820, executive appointment.
House Committee on State and Federal Affairs will come to order. Clerk will call the roll, please.
President Danforth?
Here.
President Fillmore? President Cannon?
Here.
President Cannon?
Here.
President Wilhelm? President Wyatt? President Cannell?
Here. Before we begin today, I have several announcements. First of all, if you're here today to observe the work session on Senate Bill 349 or Senate Bill 421, we will not be getting around to taking any action on either of those two bills today. Also, the amendments are being prepared at this time, Legislative Council, on House Bill 2165, so we won't get around to the work session on that until later in our agenda today. So if you're waiting for that, you might be so advised. I'm going to begin today by hearing two bills. Because the witnesses are short, also Representative Fadley has signed up to appear on one of the two bills, and those are two bills that were assigned to our committee just the other day, House Bill 3274 and House Bill 3275. So you might turn to 3274 first, and I'll call Representative Fadley.
Put it in our Oregon revised statute that a woman could establish a separate domicile from her husband. This is a bill that is considerable symbolic importance to women because of the presumption that common law seems to make that a woman is sort of a chattel, sort of a property of her husband, and where he lives, where she lives. As I say, it's symbolic, but there are also instances when it's more than symbolism. We do have instances of women who, for professional purposes, have reason to have a separate domicile, and I think you will find that happens. More frequently than you might realize. But there also are times that arise where matters like out-of-state tuition, certain rights that that a woman might deserve for herself, but because her husband is domiciled elsewhere, she loses those rights. You're going to have better testimony than mine, legal testimony, on this matter. I don't feel that I'm particularly qualified to discuss it from a legal standpoint. I just want you to know that I'm speaking for more than just myself when I say that this is a matter of symbolic importance to us. This is what the Equal Rights Movement is all about. And sometimes, as I said, it's more than symbolic when you find a situation coming up, something like the tuition question arises.
Thank you, Representative Fadley. Are there any questions for Representative Fadley? Representative Cannon.
But tuition is the only one that you can think of. Is that the only one you mentioned?
It'll come up. Let the lawyers tell you that otherwise. But that's the one that's come to my attention, the most recent one that's come to my attention.
Okay. I can give you another example.
I was not going to express my conflict of interest, but since it may possibly show, it happened that my husband was extremely fond of his farm, which is in another district. Now, he should have a right to live on that farm if he wants to, but if he lives on that farm, I'm no longer qualified to run for the state. I mean, that's really that could really be a real life situation in our family. But could I even vote for myself if he moves back to the farm? What if he leaves me? And doesn't divorce him. But that's not a deal. My own situation, that's not what he's doing, but it is, but it's very, very important.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative Wilhelm?
I came in after I started mentioning it, but contrary to that point, it would also allow husband and wife to speak off at the same time, too. You could have two separate domiciles, two separate districts, and file an election in two separate districts as a result of that. If you were domiciled, pardon me, if you were domiciled.
Representative Densmore?
You've chosen an area, however, which is very, very gray, and perhaps my colleague
very dear to my heart, and
perhaps my colleague from Plaza County would like to recount to us all of the court precedents.
There's only one that I'm familiar with. It happens to be my own. And I sure it's a very good point. To become domiciled, of course, is pretty substantial documentation in my case. When I sued the Secretary of State, that my hands they undertook an investigation of my past day one, and when I walked into the courtroom, they had on a table of that table about this size everything I can ever recall putting my name on that went in some government file, including the top line of my income tax form. And so I was able to establish domicile, but it's not an easy thing. Domicile is far more difficult to establish than residence. It's a different thing entirely. Residence is where you sleep, and domicile is where you call home, which can be different in particular, like the ones that you call into. So, if a husband and wife team are planning on setting up two different legislative people, you're going to have to go to the hell to do it. Or to the prison. Which is saying that domicile
doesn't happen. The only thing that compares now really is residence, domicile, however you want to call it, there really isn't a good test for it.
Any further questions?
I understand that the University of Oregon is in a situation where a young man who can prove he's self-supporting even though his parents otherwise can qualify for out-of-state tuition, but it's almost impossible for a self-supporting young girl. That doesn't have anything to do with this bill, except in the whole philosophy about what we're talking about, whether or not a woman is a person for herself or whether she's somebody's wife.
Thank you, Representative Bailey. Claudia Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome again to the committee.
I am Claudia Burton of Salem, Oregon. And this is the second time for me on this bill. We tried last time, I recall, at the very, very end of the session, because it seemed to come up then, coming down to a 7:30 meeting before the House Judiciary Committee. At common law, there are three classes of people who can't choose their own domicile. They are insane persons and incompetent, children, and married women. And I really find that an insult, being classified in those two groups as not being competent. The concept of domicile, namely legal residence, has some important legal consequences. It determines where you are eligible to vote, if you wish to run for political office, what area you represent. It controls where you will be taxed, where your probate will be estated, where your estate will be probated if you die. The most important practical current consequence probably is this question of payment of in-state tuition. The most common situation in which married women might wish to have a different domicile from their husbands would, I suspect, be in that student situation. But another common situation might be a woman who is not married until after she has established her own separate identity, if she marries past the age of 30 or whatever. I called the man who is the legal advisor to Oregon State University's president, Dr. McVicker, yesterday, asking him what the situation was with respect to determining residency status for married women. And he said that this problem, which I had considered to be a problem, has been mostly taken care of, and he was kind enough to send me a copy of the regulations, which I received this morning and read through. And I really regard this now as not being too great a practical problem. Although apparently there are still some married women who fall between the cracks, so to speak, and having to pay out-of-state tuition. In sum, I think that, as a practical matter, we're not talking at this point about something that makes great difference day-to-day to women. What we're talking about, as Representative Savin said, is a matter that makes a difference on principle. It's very clear, really, that this concept that a married woman may not keep her own domicile is not consistent with the Equal Rights Amendment. It's not consistent with the federal one, and several states, most recently Washington, the Attorney General, has held that it is not consistent with their Equal Rights Amendment, which they adopted just as a matter of state law. A number of states, including California, most recently had changed their statutes to say that a married woman is just as competent as a married man to her own domicile. What we end up with is a trend in state legislation to do away with this totally anachronistic provision under the common law, to allow a married woman to choose her own domicile, although it will almost always be the same as the husband, almost always. So we're talking about a matter of principle. When I married, I did not become more childish. I don't think that it was a sign of insanity. I'm an adult capable of doing that. It probably doesn't hurt me much, but then if I were a black person being told to go to the rear of the bus, it wouldn't hurt me much either. We're talking about something that makes a difference about how you feel on it inside them. I'd be glad to answer any questions if I could.
Thank you, Claudia. Question, Representative Hannah. Any relationship to how taxes are paid in this, either an ad valorem or income or anything? I don't know. It's not a set up question. I don't know. Is there any problem that we have in that?
I think, Representative Hanneman, I have to the best of my ability, but it's top of the head. What we're talking about is
how about inheritance?
Well, my understanding is that an estate is probated in the state of domicile of the person who dies. And if a married woman of 60 or 70 happened to be domiciled in another state, then that's where the estate would be probated, and that's where personal property would presumably be taxed. If we had a state income tax, well, we do have a state income tax, sure. The same thing there, if we're talking about residence versus non-resident tax. But I think we're really talking about, as a practical matter, a very, very small percentage of married women who would have states of residency different than Oregon. Very small.
Further question, Representative Kent.
What was the reason the Judiciary Committee didn't pass the bill last session?
I was trying to recall what happened. If it went in the first time, Representative Lou Hampton raised some questions about the bill because it didn't seem to specify what the domicile of the children were in that one out of 100 or two out of 100 case where a woman might have a different domicile. I'd never even heard of the bill by then, but they quickly called me and said, woman law professor, you're an expert, right? So I drafted up something that made provision for that, and I noticed some of those provisions in 1374 this time. And that satisfied Representative Hampton. I was trying to recall what happened. I think it got out of House Judiciary and simply got lost in the last minute rush because it was very new legislation.
Further questions? Thank you, Claudia.
Thank you.
Dorothy the Chaplain? If I didn't pronounce your last name correctly,
I'm Kelly Miller. I'm here representing Ann Kelly from the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. The Women's Rights Project of the ACLU is a coalition of women's groups and individuals throughout the state, including the Oregon Women's Political Caucus, the Oregon Council of Women's Equality, and the National Organization for Women. And we support 3274, so we believe that women should have the right to establish a separate domicile from that of their husband. As a university of Oregon student myself, I'm also aware of the problem that exists for married women students establishing residency for tuition purposes. We feel a married couple should be treated as two individuals instead of the concept now as one. We urge the support of the voting to make it out of the committee.
Thank you very much. Questions by the committee? Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to appear on House Bill 3274? If not, we'll set that, that'll close the hearing, and we'll set that over at the tag end of our work session today. House Bill 3275, Claudia again. I guess I could have just kept the same set of witnesses up here. It could have appeared on both. 3275.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, I'm Claudia Burton of Salem, Oregon. This is an issue that for me has more of a personal punch because I do use my own name. And I'll mention a few points of law, but for me they're not the important part of this bill. I mainly want to relate to you what my experience has been, most of them rather funny, with my practice of using my own name. This business of a married woman assuming her husband's name comes from the common law, and it was, you know, let's face it, a part of the general loss of legal identity of a married woman in a marriage when she could not sue or be sued in her own name, could not own property, could not contract. Her legal existence was simply suspended during the life of the marriage, and as a part of that, she assumed her husband's name. Women's groups have been pointing out that there also, though, is a common law a provision that anybody may change his own name at any time for any reason, so long as it's not for fraud, and some women have become concerned about that, have tried to go that route, and I think it's a viable route. The difficulty comes sometimes in dealing with state agencies who decline to recognize that action by the woman and insist on a judicial recognition of that name change, which is sometimes granted and sometimes not. There is, so far as I know, only one state that has a statutory provision requiring a woman to take her husband's name. That was in Hawaii, and that has recently been invalidated by the circuit court there based on their own state equal rights amendment. That is, I think it's fair to say, the trend of the most recent cases, but that's a very recent development. For many, many years, when a woman attempted to assert her own name, she had no luck. When I married for the first time in 1962, I took my husband's name, and I did not think very much about it one way or another. It was just customary. It wasn't an issue that anyone had raised yet. I was very happy with it. I worked for a while, then I went to law school, and then I set up practice in Southern California. There is a fair amount of prejudice against women in the legal profession, and the only way I could practice was on my own. There were no women in law firms in Riverside, so another woman and I went into practice. We were just in the general practice, and I was there for about 2 years, and it takes a long time, let me tell you, to build up a reputation in the community. Riverside is a community of 150,000, say. And it's very slow. You try and do the best possible job on a case, and you hope that if the client is satisfied, they'll spread the word. Then at the end of that period of time, my husband and I decided to separate. We've been married about 8 years. I then have the problem of starting from scratch in educating people on this reputation that goes by word of mouth, because the kind of general practice I was in, you see a client once, it isn't wasn't a business practice where you are known to a firm on a retainer basis. And it really just, the more I thought about it, the more irritated I became. And then at the time of the final decree, I asked the court to restore my maiden name to me for professional convenience, really. When I married my second husband, I decided to keep that name for the professional convenience, and also because he is an attorney, and it just seemed really it was going to work out better if we had the separate name. That was the only reason for it, professional convenience. I was aware that there was some additional content in that decision, and I'll tell you what really brought it home to me. It was reading a Hollywood gossip columnist, and Hollywood stars divorce at an incredible rate. And it was reading about the breakup of, I believe, the Jane Mansfield marriage. And the husband just couldn't have it. He was known as Mr. Jane Mansfield, which he considered an insult. And men don't like to be thought of as an appendage to their wives. Well, you know, look at it from the other point of view. To take somebody else's name is to be defined in terms of that person. I was aware of that, but it was not a strong part of my motivation. We then moved to Salem shortly after that. Had some fun times with it. My husband and I walked into Ladenbush Bank, which is a very formal, proper bank, and this immaculately groomed 45-year-old woman starts taking information for a joint checking account. We were not exactly dressed in our sippiest either, and she's keeping a straight face, total blank in terms of emotion. She's just taking information. She gets all the way to the end of it, and she looks at us and she says, "I have to ask this question, it's on the form. Are you two related?" And my husband, who's a beautiful guy, smiles and says, no, they wouldn't have let us get married if they were, at which point she just made the appropriate notation. I had an even funnier experience with the dean of the law school. I heard about the job at Willamette, and teaching in law school was something that I had dreamed about and thought impossible, and then it seemed as if it was going to come about. And I was up there at the law school for the final interview, and I had mentioned to people that I was married, but I used my own name, which they considered very odd, because it was not really all that common a thing then. So we were in for the final interview, and he starts off, and he's a beautiful gentleman, raised in the South, of about 55, he isn't there any longer, but raised in a more traditional kind of background, and he had never had contact with a liberated woman, and he wasn't really sure what this concept involved, but probably I was one of, if I did that kooky thing of using my own name. So he starts out the interview, don't care what you call yourself, but around here it's going to be Mrs. Conley. And I just sort of said, well, I hope not, and then I talked about my driver's license, my voter registration, and so on, none of which I've had any trouble with in Oregon, by the way. So we talked for a while. And then we're towards the end of the interview, and there was something he just had to know, because Willamette is a conservative institution with an even more conservative board of trustees, and there was one thing he just had to know. There's an explanation for why two people use different names, right? That's other than my comment about I just want to use my own name. And he was so embarrassed to ask the question, he just wanted to ask one, but he wanted the answer. He leaned forward in this very uncle-y way that's now funny. Tell me one thing. Do you have piece of paper with the word marriage license on it? And I responded to him that I did, and he then allowed us out, okay. And we went like that. That was at the beginning of my use of my own name. I had only been married for the second time, several months, two or three. And as I say, I initially did it for professional convenience, but let me tell you, not many details, but just in conclusion, it has meant a great deal to me emotionally. I didn't mind it, didn't even think of it during my first marriage, which was 8 years long. But as I have lived with it, I've now been married only 4.5 years. It is a statement about I'm my own person that I'm happy with, my husband's happy with, and it's been a great deal. I hope to pass the bill.
Thank you, Claudia. Questions by members of the committee? Representative Hamm.
On page 4, the court must decree a change if it's requested. That's in the case of either spouse requesting that the change of name, isn't it, of either spouse?
Yes.
There's no criteria for refusal of that. It's just that the court must allow a change of name if it's requested. Was this in a previous bill in another session? And if so, any credit or lending agencies or retail people or any object to that in not being able, if people change their names frequently, to be able to keep track of those who owe money to charge accounts or so on. I don't know if that's a good point to bring up, but is it a problem that
I'll have to guess, Representative Cannon. I was not involved with this issue the last session, but my response in terms of why this provision is here and the extent which will be inconvenient to credit agencies, I can not research it, but give you a common sense answer to it. The reason it's there is that sometimes a woman at the end of the marriage will ask to have her name, her pre-marriage name, returned to her, and occasionally courts deny that. So that's why it's there. To the extent,
why would a court deny that?
I think that they are concerned, Representative Hanneman, about their fears of the difficulty that children might face if they still have their father's name, but their mother's name is now different from that. A concern which I've never been able to understand, because it is so frequent that a woman, particularly a young woman who's divorced, will remarry and take her second husband's name, and so the names will be different. But I think that's the common reason for it. On the credit thing, if I could
go ahead.
I believe that credit agencies keep track by social security number, and things are indexed that way. It is, to me, a simpler idea for a woman to keep the same name sort of all the way through. But I think that they distinguish even between similar names by use of the social security numbers. I would not think it to be a problem.
Thank you. Also, I might add Representative Hammond that that would probably be, the reason I added it is because this did occur in the Interim Committee on Labor, Business, and Consumer Affairs, and the question did arise. And I think it's obvious that this would be a much more trackable kind of a thing if you wanted to change your name for our credit union to be able, our credit agency to be able to find you. If you're going to be able to go through a court proceeding and simply somebody says, my name's John Smith, and then as you walk out, say you walk down the street now, you say your name's John Jones, and you don't bother to tell anybody. And I think that's more of a problem than someone going to a court and getting their name changed. Representative Wyatt and Representative Smith.
On page 2, it says, consistent with the public interest interest, but generally, protective language.
Again, I'm guessing, Representative Wyatt, I saw the bill half an hour ago. The kinds of reasons that one would use, in my opinion, to deny a name change would be if it was for purposes of fraud or for evading creditors or to adopt the name of a famous celebrity or a famous political figure, I suppose, if you wanted to run for office. But rather concrete, specific things like that would be my guess.
Further questions? Representative Simpson.
One guy, two questions. Is anybody signed up to testify in opposition to this bill?
There's no one here if you're in opposition to the bill. No. Matter of fact, there was no one if you're in opposition to either bill. Representative Burroughs is here on House Bill 3275, and I think we should allow her the opportunity to speak. Representative Burroughs?
Thank you.
And would you accept the motion on either of these bills?
As soon as we close the hearing on this bill and they're both moved over, one is already moved over to the work session. And I'd be happy to do that in front of Representative Bailey and Representative Burroughs.
I didn't hear what you're about to do.
I'm about to take a motion, but I want you to go ahead and
take your thing. For the record.
But before
the record, I'm Representative Mary McCauley Burroughs.
Is that your husband's name or?
That is the way I was officially elected, and I'm from District 41. I'm supposed to be at room 209, and I'm trying to save a bill at some table, so if I seem distracted, I do apologize. There are a few people, in case Representative Hannon is about to do what he's saying. There are a few people who would like to testify very much. They were under the impression it would be Friday, and Norma Follis, Representative Follis, is one of them. I just want to say very briefly, I think the whole concept of this name business really a sort of historical thing, and I have a feeling it came from the Middle East. I was going to teach a Sunday school class about women in the church, and I hope I'm right because I didn't go back and check Matthew, but when I looked at the genealogy of Christ, I believe it's 44 generations mentioned. Two women are mentioned and one that he had a wife, which I thought was very nice. But even in the genealogy of Christ, there wasn't women didn't seem to have too much of a prominent part of that. Also, I think a lot of this is just custom. Latin America is very, that was a little tidbit of it you didn't know. Latin America, it's part of their custom for a woman to retain her maiden name. When we were in Seattle, I remember a Chinese couple, and their oldest son had his father's last name. The second son had his mother's maiden name, and it was part of their family custom that should a woman or a couple, how do I say this very quickly? Should the woman have been from a family of all daughters, it was custom for the second son to take the maiden name of the mother. That way the name was perpetuated, which I thought was kind of a nice custom. The name business has always bothered me a little bit, and I think one reason when I was growing up, my mother was always saying we would do something, she'd say that's the Coddington name. And I knew this was important to her. And then she went through effort to go back and do the genealogy, and I think she went back to about 1600. One thing that sort of fascinated me, we would have the names, let's say Bill Coddington had two sons, Paul, Alan, and Bill, and two daughters. Would mention maybe who they had married, not the last name, just first, and then would go on, if they had three sons and four daughters, they would go on to mention that what the names were. They didn't even bother to name the first, there was no records kept of the daughter's name, or if it wasn't, just the first name of who they married. And I'm not sure this is always right. I thought about it a lot with my own self, and I consider myself as Mary McCauley. I consider my title as Mrs. Charles Burroughs. When I was thinking about running for the legislature, I asked my husband what he thought about my running as Mary McCauley Burroughs.
And we talked to Clay Myers, and he said, oh, he wouldn't do it, because usually a candidate will shorten their name. T. Lawson McCall became Tom McCall. He was, I believe, Clay Myers Sr. Anyway, 2 days before I filed for office, my father died very unexpectedly, and I suppose it gave me the leverage to do what I'd wanted to do, which is sort of a futile effort because everybody's ignored it. But I do think it's part of my heritage, and I am proud of it, and it sort of bothers me that it doesn't seem so important to a lot of other people. I think another thing you should think about is really who is the person. And I said, I think I'm a Macaulay, and my title is Burroughs. I'm thinking about a friend of mine who was a teacher, who was widowed twice before she was 40. She was born a Talbot, she married a Cook, she married a Vanderzan, and both of those were deceased. Really, who is she? I asked her one time if she was about to be married, and she said, I wouldn't want to go through the whole hassle of a name change, and I don't blame her. I think you really, this deal, God loves Representative Hammond.
I asked her, Mr. Chairman, if she had anything to say about the bill.
Oh, very good. And I think that these are simply...
I'm trying to remember what the name of that bill
is. My
comments are just to
remarks,
asking you to endorse a concept that I think a lot of women out of custom have adopted.
Thank you, Representative Burroughs. Are there any questions by members of this committee with the exception of Representative Hammond?
He really is a dear friend.
Yes, well.
I was talking about a concept, and I should offer my apologies to Representative Hammond. What is your wife's maiden name?
I can't recall.
Oh, well, that's my other, that was my other comment. If you've ever registered voters, oh, I forgot, my secretary wants to testify very briefly, and if she can't, I'll tell you the story. Representative Williams already knows. If any of you have ever registered voters, it's a real education. First thing I noticed, you register voters, what is your mother's maiden name? And I would guess that half of the people you registered do not know their own mother's maiden name. I don't understand this, I don't know why. It's not that uncommon.
Their mother's maiden name.
Okay, to speak to the bill, if that's what Representative Hammond wants. That's what I'll tell you a story if you want to. My secretary was divorced a year ago. She'd been married 2 years. She did not have children. She asked for her maiden name back. The judge asked her why she wanted her name back, which she considered her name all along. And being a little bit gutsy, she said she didn't think it was any of his business. And he gave her name back. It still was under his jurisdiction and prerogative whether she were to get her name back or not. It was up to him. It did not matter what her own wishes were, what name she was born with. Anyway, that was part of the divorce decree and some questions he asked. Oh, you're making
You
can. In political names.
Yeah.
Could you?
Yes, Representative Denmore.
If you want to take a motion or two, I don't.
Do you have a motion, Representative Denmore?
I move that we send, what's the first bill?
74, 3274.
I move we send House Bill 3274 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Denmore moves that House Bill 3274 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Motion passed.
General.
Representative Densmore.
I'm moving to send House Bill 3275 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Densmore moves that House Bill 3275 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk, call roll.
Representative Densmore.
Aye.
Representative Gilmore.
Representative Burroughs, would you like to carry out Bill 3275?
If Representative Hammond will help me, I'd be glad to.
All right, I'm sure that he'll help you out. And Representative Fabley, would you like to carry out Bill 3274? Okay, thank you very much. And I apologize the other witnesses didn't have an opportunity to testify, but I think that your purposes were served. You're welcome. I'll now briefly open a hearing on Senate Bill 948. Senator Atiyah is here and would like to testify on the bill. National Guard Museum, as I recall. Senator Atiyah? 348. Welcome to committee, Senator Tia.
Chairman, I became aware of the fact that the Oregon National Guard was beginning to gather, and almost too late, some military artifacts, documents, and so forth into a museum. They've done this quite well and have kept meticulous track of what they were doing. But then they asked me if, in fact, they got worried whether or not they could legally accept the items that had been donated to them. So I checked with Legislative Council, and Senate Bill 948 is the result of that. They are working in this area. This now says that they can accept the contributions that are given to them for this military department. Now, I know that we've got a couple of representatives from the military department here, and I want to tell the committee what I said on the floor of the Senate, because as I was getting ready to carry Senate Bill 948, I saw a fiscal impact on the bill. And I will tell you what I said to the Senate, which may be contradictory to what the military may tell you after I finish, if you allow them to talk, and if you don't want to pass the bill out, that's okay with me too. That the impact, and I don't recall what it was, really shocked me. And I called fiscal and I said, where in the world did you come up with this impact? And they said they got that from, I guess, General Miller, but I'm not quite sure, at least from the military department. And I said, carrying the bill on the floor of the Senate, so that at present time, this is being done on a volunteer basis. And that I believe it's an important thing that they're doing, and I certainly do. However, I am not demanding, or by my vote, or encouraging the Senate to vote, requesting the military department to spend money for this. And if they also feel that it's important, and then within their budget, they find the means to do it. The budget is proposed by Ways and Means. And so I tell you the same thing, that I think it's important. This gives them the authority to do it. If they believe it's important, and I do, then it should be done within the budget that's allowed to them by the Oregon legislature and not in addition to. And with that, then, if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer. They do have some very, very fine artifacts that and those kinds of things are swiftly being depleted or destroyed. And I mean significant items, not just uniforms. There's a lot of or a few other things. They're getting some very unique items, and I think they're valuable, and I agree with it. But this gives them the authority to do it legally.
Thank you, Senator. Questions? Representative Hanneman and Representative Simpson.
If it comes out of their existing budget and there's no additional appropriation, would that mean that they would discontinue hauling the recyclable materials from community organizations in order to build a museum?
Actually, the building, first of all, right now there's a room. The public doesn't have access to it. It's my understanding that there is going to be, this is a Kent Whitman, incidentally, here in Clackamas area. There's a building that will become available, and it's their intention to use that. My answer to my question, of course, I would say to you that I don't know where they would do it. I don't really see where it's going to cost the money that they say it's going to cost. I really don't. And that a lot of volunteer effort, including Lieutenant Aitken, who is the one that's concerning himself personally with it. I don't necessarily like to see volunteer effort, yet I think this is a worthy volunteer effort to be done on that basis with property they now own. What I'm saying to you, well, is I don't really see what's going to cost money. They provided some forms, which they have, to give to the donor, and there's someone has to worry themselves about it, but I don't see what it should cost any more money. And I told the Senate I was not asking them, and I was just expressing directly to them as I asked you.
Representative Simpson, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. What's the figure?
I don't recall now. 20,000 or 40,000 or something. I had them. They came out of maybe.
I think we'll have the opportunity.
We'll have the opportunity to direct them toward
General Austin or some of the other witnesses. Representative Simpson, another question.
There are no, thank you, Mr. Chairman. No existing museums where each artifact would fit in now without the.
Well, each county, as you know, or many counties have their own historical society, county historical societies, and the Oregon Historical Society has some things. We're talking about things that relate to the Oregon National Guard, and they do have some very neat things. I think we ought to have some description of them. I'm trying to remember a large plaque, let me call it, with a trophy of some kind, rather elaborate, large painting, man in uniform, uniforms, books that relate to the history of the Oregon National Guard. I can't honestly say that I think that there is at least a concentration anywhere. There are pieces, I'm sure, in all these museums, including the Oregon Historical Society. But I don't think that there's anything like this. And it would be mostly interesting to those that are involved with the military, but I think that's quite appropriate.
Further questions? Representative Wyatt.
As we have had other statutes that talk about various agencies of government, we even have a DEQ and a variety of statutes that they can buy, sell, lease, accept contributions. So we have to give them authority to accept it. Why we do, I'm not really sure. It was a question, and they've accepted things, and they've given receipts for them. And so we're talking about a body of the Oregon government, and apparently we have to give them authority so legally they can accept it. Now, I feel I can't answer why, but we do that in a lot of agencies, and we always put in accept contributions.
Another question.
I think Lieutenant Aiken did, the gentleman who was working in that museum, and I tell you, the whole thing is that I'm a gun collector, and there's a gun collector's meeting where this takes place, and it's in the National Guard Armory in Lexington. And I walked in there and saw what they were doing, and the whole question came out of that.
Further questions? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much.
Anyone in opposition to this bill?
I would like to. I don't believe so. As a matter of fact, only Senator T has signed up, but I see General Austin back there, and you might come on up, General Austin, or whoever else you have with you.
Chairman, before it begins, I'd like to go for the record and state that I've gotten a communication from a photojournalist, a freelance person in my district who would see this bill as an important bill and would like to contribute some things that he has to it.
General Austin.
Chairman, I'm General Austin, Deputy State Adjutant General. My boss, Dale Miller, is in Carson City, Fort Carson, Colorado, today, or he would have been here. I'm the guy that wrote the fiscal impact statement that Senator Kia referred to, and I think maybe I can clarify what that was all about. The military department does support this bill. We would like to have it passed. The thing that, I might give you just a little background, we recognized the need some time ago for this kind of a thing, in conjunction with the Oregon Military Academy, which is our officer candidate school that operates at Camp Whittingham. The academy is the primary source of all new second lieutenants in the Oregon Army National Guard. And part of their training, as they go through a year-long process prior to being commissioned, is to do some research and to write some papers, usually on military subjects. And we found class after class of these young cadets turning out papers on George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and Dwight Eisenhower, all of the generals that have been famous nationally. And at the same time, we recognized that there was very little good documentation about the history of the Oregon National Guard, which really dates back to about 15 years before statehood. And to kind of put those two things together, we thought if we could accumulate some resources that our cadets could use for reference material, that we could use their writing and research ability then to compile over a period of time a history that we don't have. So that's why we started accumulating things at Camp Whittingham. We really didn't realize how much there was that was available. As Lieutenant Aitken, who is working as a part-time curator out there, has gone around and talked to people about contributing things to our collection and this sort of thing, we've really had people kind of come out of the woodwork and bring us things that we didn't even know existed. We're really being almost swamped. When you take that, the quantities that we've been getting and the fact that Lieutenant Aitken is very interested and very enthusiastic about this, and this gets us to where we are today. We have one room in the Camp Whittingham Armory, and it's literally at this point bulging from the seams with very excellent and very badly needed material. It's being received, it's being cataloged by Lieutenant Aiken on a volunteer basis. He works full time for the department, and we're letting him spend one day a week out there because we have so much off his regular job onto this other job. He also has some volunteer part time help from some local senior citizens. And right now, we're just about out of room. We're just barely able to cope with the material that we've received, and we have really no potential for displaying it at all as we are now. Now, there are several things that we could do. We do want to We like the bill because it gives us the legal authority to send that TF spoke about, and that's the first thing we need. An even better solution, and this is where we get into the funding, the impact that we talked about, would be to pursue the idea of a military museum, eventually one that we could open to the public, or at least to school groups, people like that, at Camp Whittaker. Now, we have a building there. It's a house. It's now rented. It will be vacant later this year, and with very limited funding, we could put Lieutenant H. in that building as a full-time curator. We would need some basic burglar protection in terms of a detection system of some kind because of the value of the items, and particularly because there are some weapons involved. And probably build some showcases, some things like that, and really relate to Oregon history as the guards is involved. We go all the way back to the 1844, to the Modoc Wars. We have information that documents those things, and we'd like to be able to show that to the public. So there are three ways we can go. The first one, of course, is to pass the bill as it is, which is what Senator Tia has asked for. This gives us the legal authority we need to make what we've done up to this point more valid than it is, and will let us then continue to receive for and receive a limited number of artifacts. The second alternative would be to fund it, and I can give you figures on that. The $20,000 figure that Senator Tia mentioned was only estimated for 1 year of this biennium if we were to go that route. And then about $40,000 in succeeding biennium to cover the salary of one person, some insurance on the things that we have, and then some minor maintenance on the building and gradual construction of a selection of showcases. Third alternative, which would be don't approve it at all, would at this point in time cause us to back off from where we are now, scale down what we're doing, and get back to the basic research purpose that we started out with. We would have to tell a lot of people, no, I'm sorry, we can't use the things that you have to offer. This would greatly disappoint a large number of living veterans and the descendants of deceased veterans of the Oregon National Guard, and would be a disappointment to the military department and the military academy. I can respond to any questions that the committee might have, Mr. Chairman, and also can give you a specifics on the fund estimate if you'd like to have.
Thank you, General Austin. Questions by members of the committee? I believe not. General, I just might say, and not as a question, but I think it might be wise simply to pass this bill out to the floor and try and get the concept over first rather than attempt to get some funding for it at this time. I think that might prove to be difficult with all the other fiscal constraints that we're looking at.
So we understand that, and basically we want to be on the record as interested in pursuing this greater policy in the future.
Thank you very much. I have a copy. I can leave it. Thank you. Representative Hannon moves Senate Bill 948 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Just to say that I heartily concur with you when other programs are pressing at the present time that we don't have any alternative for that the Guard is helping us out with. I'm not opposed to establishing the precedent, but I hope they don't spend the money for a while.
Further discussion?
Well, let's go ahead and collect it. Get the thing on the book
right. Clerk, call roll.
Aye.
Motion passed. Thank you. I'll carry the bill. Do you mind?
Go ahead.
Could I? A biting interest in history. Bob, I understand you're here on Senate Bill 820, but I have some other business I'd like to conclude as far as the work session before Representative Dinsmore has to leave, which is just momentarily. Representative Gilmore, did you want about a minute or two recess before we take up some of the bills that we have on? I'm going to skip past the hearing aid bill, and I'm going to move down into starting with the bill 2465 and then move down that list. Do I have amendments yet to 2165, by the way? Okay.
Oh,
the hearing aid bill, okay. I don't have the amendments yet on that. So that's where I'm going to begin.
Well, I did not see the 2652, which
oh,
I mean.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I'm
going to go ahead and just move through the agenda.
Sure.
All right, fine. All right, let's start our work session then on House Bill 2465. And I understand we have some amendments again. Representative Wyatt. Can Mr. Bugis out there talking? tell them the fishmers are built that. I don't need to talk anymore. Oh, okay. All members of the committee, I understand, then received, with the exception of the chairman, received copies of the amendments dated May 14. However, I will admit I had them presented to me in my office earlier this morning on the House bill. And did you also get an explanation of what the particular amendments did or didn't do? Yeah, I'm going to wait then until Representative White gets back and also the end gets back to explain the amendments. I wonder if Deanne will now change her name back to Butterfield, assuming that bill back to the Senate, or she'll stay with the name Clinton. I'm waiting for Representative White to return.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
With that in mind, I wonder if we could move to House Bill 2652.
I'd still like to wait until Representative White gets here on that one, too. We have a report on that. I have some amendments on the bill to take care of the financial responsibility that Representative Hanneman has suggested. And then we have a report from Deanne as to what the Department of Education said or didn't say. How do I do that? Let's do 2688 while we're waiting for Representative Wyatt.
Okay. Manhunt in the Department of Education is outside typing up something. Should I have her come in and present it orally?
Well, don't we have some amendments? First of all, let's take up the amendment first. Okay. Actually, it's a substitute bill. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Proposed substitution for House Bill 2688. And Section 1 retains the definition of air rifle. Section 2 says that any negligence or intentional misconduct of a person under age 16 years when discharging an air rifle shall be imputed to his parent or legal guardian, who shall be liable for any damages to the person or property caused by such negligence or intentional misconduct. Section 3 then says the State Wildlife Commission shall prepare a statement of warning that will be distributed to all purchasers of air rifles that will include the following information. One, it will inform the purchaser that the air rifle is dangerous and should be used accordingly. Two, it will outline safe handling procedures that should be followed. Three, it will inform the purchaser of the parental liability as provided in Section 2 of the Act. And then it says in Sub 2 of that section, the Wildlife Commission may collect a fee to recover the cost of printing and distributing the forms. Section 4 says no retailer shall sell an air rifle to any person without giving the purchaser a copy of the statement prepared. Section 3. Representative Denny Horn.
Who did the Wildlife Commission collect a fee from?
Anybody who wants a copy of the form.
They claim the wholesaler didn't we specify or when we're going to specify
if the.
Or the retailer there.
If the retailer wants the Wildlife Commission to actually prepare the thing for them, then the Wildlife Commission may charge a fee. If the retailer wants to just make up his own, then he can do it.
Well, I don't think
that
I don't think it says that. It says the Wildlife Commission shall prepare a statement of warning to be distributed to all purchasers of air rifles. So I assume that has to go out to the retailer. Is that correct?
You gotta prepare them. Function you're talking about there. They collect a fee is who they collect it from, right?
See, they have to collect it from the retailer. It'd be the logical thing. The person comes in the air rifle for whatever the cost of the form or forms were. Who prepared them? I think we're better specifying that exactly how we're going to do that. Is there anyone here from the Wildlife Commission?
How do you want it to work?
I don't see
need to be if they're going to buy the air rifle, and we're requiring the Wildlife Commission to give them a safe warning about it. If you're going to charge a fee to anyone, you got to charge it to the purchaser.
Well, if it's charged to the retailer, would it be on there and you pass it on and price the air rifle?
Not necessarily, I wouldn't think.
Seems to me that would be up to the retailer.
In the second place, I'm not sure that it's going to cost that much money to reproduce the...
Yeah, I'm not sure you couldn't just delete stuff too, and they're going to print some sort of a form that's going to be handed out everywhere they sell anything.
Well,
I think
that's a very small budget, how's my concern? We don't want to break up the budget.
Well, I never heard about 30 million.
Yeah, no. We increased it by 20% this
session. I think with the
delete sub 2 section.
Yeah, I think they could absorb the cost of this particular.
Well, I think section 4 would say you can't sell an air rifle to a person without giving the purchaser a copy of the statement. And I think Representative Dinsmore is suggesting that they go ahead and prepare the statement, but they don't have to collect a fee. In other words, delete sub 2 of section 3, assuming they can absorb that cost in their budget. Say, well, why don't we get a hold of someone from the Wildlife Commission from the office, and let's find out what that's going to cost. If they can absorb that in their budget, then we can go ahead and simply delete sub 2 and then take some action on the bill if we wish to at that time.
I'm a little concerned that they don't have a mailing list for all of the retailers in the state who may sell them. I think it would be a little administrative problem getting these things distributed out to all retailers.
I think it would be up to the retailers.
But how does he get informed of the change in the law, though?
Yeah. Let's just set that one over for a little while.
Chairman?
Yeah.
I would ask the analyst in front of the committee to have my report recorded as I on House Bill 3274.
3274. All right. Representative Gilmore asked that you be unanimous consent to change his vote on House Bill 3274. Is there any objection?
Mr. Chairman, before you put that, it seems to me that Representative Gilmore objected once when I asked to change my vote.
I remember that too.
Well, apparently there are three objections.
No
objection. I see. I guess they didn't
want to. But each of us one.
All right. I'll direct the clerk then to be sure and change the vote, be sure that he's recorded his voting aye on House Bill 3274.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. House Bill 2460. Well, at the risk of having a field day over everybody changing their votes here and there, is there any objection to that? So ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman. How did you change it?
From vote aye.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize the women's caucus on the floor of the assembly was that powerful. Apparently, some of you must have some bills residing from other committees.
Mary Burrow, Secretary of the was a rather close personal friend of mine.
Well, I hope you can renew that friendship.
I have to leave you. I don't wish you to change.
Could I get 2465 in that case? I've been concerned about getting through some of these today. 2465. What do we have here in the amendment? Deanne, can you explain this?
These amendments do what I told you the other amendments did.
Okay. All right.
I hope everybody got my little note this morning. What these amendments do is provide that the Bureau of Labor would investigate possible discrimination in establishments licensed by the OLCC. And if after the hearing procedure, the commissioner determines that there is discrimination, then he will write a letter to the OLCC recommending that the license be suspended or canceled. The second thing that the bill does is add to the list of about a dozen reasons that the OLCC can suspend licenses. It adds at the very end the reason that the OLCC has received such a letter from the Bureau of Labor. And That's the end.
Question? Any minute?
Moved
the adoption. Representative White moved the adoption of the amendment dated May 14, 1975. Is there a discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Lieutenant Gilmore?
Aye.
Lieutenant Gilmore?
No.
Lieutenant Hayden?
No.
Lieutenant Simpson?
Aye.
Lieutenant Wilhelm?
Aye.
Lieutenant Bryant?
Aye.
Lieutenant Kino?
Aye. Motion passes. Anybody else have a motion on the bill? Or?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gilmore.
I move we reconsider the vote by which we sent out House Bill 2652.
Let's stick to 2465 right now. I guess the bill before us. Representative White moves House Bill 2465 to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Lieutenant Gilmore?
Aye.
Lieutenant Gilmore?
No.
Lieutenant Hammond?
No.
Lieutenant Simpson?
No.
Lieutenant Wilhelm?
No.
Lieutenant Wyatt?
Aye.
Lieutenant Kino?
Aye. Motion fails.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to explain my vote.
All
right. I received this morning a couple of telegrams that showed you, and I suspect that some other select members of the committee also communicated. But I received these communications on an increasing basis, increasing from the point at which petitions were filed in the office of Secretary of State for my recall. And I'm getting awfully tired of members of the lobby who see someone in a rather vulnerable position communicating with the interested parties in my district in this fashion. I'm getting tired of receiving telegrams 3 seconds before I'm about ready to vote on a bill indicating displeasure with the XYZ position. And it happened on this particular venture and in a very, I think, unseemly way. And to the individual who directed that communication, I'd like to voice my displeasure. I don't think that's the way the legislative process should work, and it's going to have absolutely no impact bearing on my vote. Regardless of the fact that the bill didn't pass out of committee, I think it ought to, and I think it's done for one another it may.
Thank you, Representative Wilhelm, Representative Wyatt. I think your point's well taken, that a veiled threat is nonetheless a threat. And I certainly, for one, object to that kind of process being attempted as we're attempting to deliberate on bills. And I know that that's happened on more than one occasion to various members, not only this committee, but also the legislative body, particularly as certain lobbyists have attempted to find what they determined was the weak underbelly, rather than looking at or attempting to support a bill on its particular merits or demerits, or present their arguments on its particular merits or demerits. And I certainly hope that it doesn't occur again. But if it does occur again, I would suggest, Representative Wyatt, and I join with you, I would suggest that you make that case public, pointing out those individuals, and I certainly would go along with you in sharing my concern in that regard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Alright, fine.
I have a feeling you might need my vote.
Alright, let's go to House Bill 2165 on hearing aids. Are the amendments here yet? And what's the approximate time that we can expect those amendments?
Heavily
standing
over the
sign. Alright, okay. Let's hear from Mr. Olson. He's here. Representing Senator Hurd, I assume.
Yes, sir.
You're not here as a private individual.
No.
You're legislative staff. On Senate Bill 820.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to say that this is a housekeeping bill, but in fact, it's more than that. It has to do with the executive appointments made by the governor, and we feel it clarifies existing law. Under existing law, if someone it says that if someone is not confirmed by the Senate, the governor's office will look at somebody else for confirmation. It does not really say specifically that this person cannot serve, and we're trying to change that to clarify the point that if somebody is not confirmed by the Senate, then they cannot serve in that position. And over the years, historically, there has been some debate. There's been some, I don't know of any particular case on this issue. I don't think anybody's been willing to bring it up, but there has been some problems with this particular statute and its wording. So we're attempting with Senate Bill 820 to change that. Basically, it kind of establishes three categories. It takes two-thirds to approve or disapprove of the six people on the committee. And there's a middle ground there where, you know, it'd be a split vote, which would also be a message, we think, probably to the governor.
All right, questions by members of the committee? Representative Hanneman.
Is there any other situation where an absent vote is not a negative vote, where you have to be present to cast a negative vote before you show your intention?
I'm not sure of that.
Maybe a good idea. I don't know. I just,
this is really a special committee, and I'm not sure if there's other precedent or not. Maybe Attorney General's office would know. Yeah, I think it's to make sure that there's a, you know, the confirmation is, or non-confirmation is an important business, and I think that needs to be.
Representative Hanneman.
Well, of course, to keep people from taking a walk is usually covered by the presence of a quorum. I don't see anything wrong with requiring a negative vote, I guess. Only we require positive votes and everything else.
Yeah, but this is a, you know, you're taking action on somebody's appointment, and that should be action. I think the feeling is that there should be action one way or the other. I was not present at most of the discussion on this bill in the Senate, but I do know that this was thoroughly debated, and this is what they decided was the best approach.
Colton, what would occur then? Let's say that there wasn't a majority, and the individual an appointee can't serve. That's correct. He's not appointed. He's not confirmed. That is
a two-thirds vote either way.
All right. The committee. I'm saying the committee doesn't vote. The committee can't confirm him, nor can they turn him down. Then what occurs? I suppose then this appointment stands or it doesn't stand.
Well, as I suggest in my testimony, there are really three areas for the confirmation or denial of confirmation, or the third area, which would allow the person to hold the position, but I think that would also be a message to the governor that there's some disfavor with this person. In other words, I think the Senate felt that the governor should not be denied the chance to appoint his person and have that person serve if the committee was evenly divided in that kind of situation.
Further questions? Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else wishing to carry on Senate Bill 820? Includes carrying on Senate Bill 820. Let's take one of the longest list. Senator House Bill 3266. Did Representative Cullen got me on the same bill? I finally signed up for December yet.
My name is Harry Kosmeski. I live at 540 Taylor Street, Mount Angel. I'm a legislative spokesman for the United Veterans Group, as you all well know, a group composed of the State Department, the American Legion, the Disabled American Veterans, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the United States Veterans of World War I, the Military Order of Purple Heart, the Spanish American War Veterans and Associated Organizations. The meetings of UVGO are open to all interested parties and to be heard as well as seen as such. Now, House Bill 3266 is an extremely important measure to all veterans in the state of Oregon. I might add at this point, in this juncture, that we consider it probably one of our most important measures that we have before the legislature this session. It should not be necessary to conduct these deliberations where all the counties in the state to simply abide by the provisions of ORS's 408.710 through 408.750, which clearly spell out in detail the obligation of the state of Oregon undertook over 100 years ago to see that those war veterans of that period
and in the future who served their country faithfully would and should be entitled to, not special considerations necessarily, but recognition should they become indigent later in life. Thus, with the birth of the Indigent Veteran Program, an attempt was begun to show appreciation for oftentimes extremely dangerous missions which resulted in loss of life, wounds and injuries serious enough to impair the earning capacity of any particular individual, or illnesses contracted as a direct result of service to the country which later impaired the activities of the individual in a normal manner. Now, during the intervening years between its adoption by the state legislature and today, numerous minor changes have been made in its wording, but it obviously still lacks the strength in its context to impel all counties to not only observe its contents, but to even implement any portion of it thereof. In fact, the most densely veteran populated as well as generally populated county in the state, namely Multnomah, has apparently decided that there is no validity to the ORS cited and has chosen to eliminate it after administering such a fund for many, many years. Other counties do not provide for this fund either, and some fund it through the general funds as required, but in conjunction with other programs. Several counties have doubled up their resources and services with other adjacent counties, and in other words, it has become a hodgepodge of programming in order to either comply, treat indifferently, or completely ignore the ORS as written and carried in the statute. Much of the blame for this lies in the fact that a great deal of the wording contained in the original statute is archaic in that it deals with such veterans who served in Indian War. It also seemingly addresses itself primarily to the defraying of costs of the veteran's funeral, when in reality that is only a part of its intent. It also is made to sound more permissive in nature than mandatory, and that's probably the most important portion that we're trying to get across to the legislature at this time. House Bill 3266 clarifies much of this, and while not perfect, it does eliminate a great deal of language superfluous to the requirements and the implementation directions. Above all else, it does make it a mandatory fund, and herein rests the reason for it being introduced late in the session of this year's legislature. This bill was introduced in identical language in the Senate, but was determined to be a revenue measure and thus was about to be literally dumped until we managed to salvage it and bring it to the correct chamber, the House. We desire to thank this committee for the expeditious manner in which it is being heard today. There are two amendments in the wording which we previously asked the Senate to make, which were not incorporated in this, the House bill edit. And they are, number one, on line 20 of page 2, after the word dishonorable, insert these words, or clemency, before the word discharge. Also, on page 2, line 30, after the word the relief fund, insert the word shall, and delete the word may to bring this into conformity with the rest of the measure and require an officer to be appointed to administer the fund in each county. And this does not mean that it would necessarily hold true that this individual could not hold another title, as in the case of sparsely populated counties. Of tremendous importance is the fact that the funding for the administration of the fund would no longer be realized from the general fund of each county as it now is done, but rather from the fund itself, which is a complete departure from the original statute. Also, much has been made of late by certain counties that they would probably not need that much money as is proposed to be levied for this a specific program, and it would be noted that it spells out quite explicitly that a tax to be levied by law not exceeding 1/80 of 1%, and so forth. And this would seem to allow much leeway to those counties afraid of too great a levy or ending up with excess funds at the end of any year. We do not know at this point just how many counties have actually levied this tax and are continuing to do so and not using it for the purpose for which it is intended. And by that I mean that it was buried in a program of taxation that may have been a package deal. But we do know that up until last year, apparently Multnomah County used some funds from sources for this purpose and now feels it is a duplication of services and therefore unnecessary. To this, we must disagree. And I must apologize at this point for citing Multnomah because I'm more familiar with its problems and the notoriety given to it in recent weeks and so forth. To this, we must disagree. And in that there is no way we can be induced into believing, number one, that veterans of wars are not unique to their country, and two, there is another service such as this that would offer to veterans who suddenly, through no fault of their own, find themselves without means of procuring the necessities of life.
There are others who possess greater facts concerning not only the need for immediate assistance in many cases to those who lack the aforementioned necessities of life, but also the amounts allocated in past years in various counties for this purpose, to include a high of roughly $500,000 in Multnomah County in either 1934 or 1935, to a low of approximately $5,000 for this past year. The monies go to those who need funds to defray immediate needs of food, clothing, heat, light, etc., on a very temporary basis, and yet could be used for longer periods should the conditions of specific cases require. Burial needs have become secondary to the needs of life, and that is what we propose to do, and assist our veterans from being required to go on the welfare roll. In conclusion, it must be pointed out that the existing statutes require, and this is an important factor too, should any county fail to levy a tax for this purpose to pay for its existence out of the general fund of that, it must be paid for out of the general fund of that county. Statute so big. There's no alternative. It also allows that in the event there is no war veterans organization within a county who could possibly administer this fund, that if it were properly recognized and bonded, that a county judge could be responsible for its distribution. We therefore see this bill, House Bill 3266, as simply a house cleaning bill designed to make the Indigent Veterans Fund, which is probably a misnomer, and it would be more appropriate to entitle it the Indigent Veterans Emergency Fund, not only clearly mandatory, but much clearer in language, so that all counties in the state of Oregon operate uniformly in regard to not only the funding, but the administration as well. We further urge the committee to pass recommendation to the House so it may move to the Senate as soon as practical and with due expedience. And I, at this time, would entertain, I've had, when this was originally proposed and presented in the on the Senate side, under Senate Bill 304, I didn't have the expertise that I now possess, and I don't have a great deal because I can't furnish too many figures, but there has been so much that has taken place since then that I do know a little bit more about it than I did at that time, and I would entertain any questions that you might have.
Representative White?
I'll say what we do. How much money
would there be? There would be no way of really saying, because it would be taken on a county. This is one of the questions that's been posed by all of us as to how much money. In fact, the program, Multnomah County itself, asked us to ask to give them a figure as to what would be needed. Now, if you're talking about 1/80th or 1%, then you'd have to utilize the total evaluation of the state. But if it says up to 1/80th of 1%, it could be anything in between there. So I have no way of not exceeding 1/80th of 1%. Well, whatever the evaluation is at present time of the state in property, it's several hundred million, 200 million, I understand, somewhere in that neighborhood.
That's what it would
be? No, no, oh no, that would be a total evaluation that takes 1/80th of 1% of that. You're not going to come up with
a little more than $200 million.
Well, no, oh, yeah, right. I'm it's in billions, I'm sorry.
You don't have those figures, though, right?
No, no.
Your cash value of counties,
no.
How much money we're talking about?
No.
For example, it might be quite a bit for the Indian veterans in, say, Wheeler County, because of the true cash value being a great deal, but not very many Indian veterans in Wheeler County, as opposed to maybe a county like Multnomah County. Now, that probably would be a good example. As a matter of fact, Clackamas County maybe would be a better example, and there might be a great many people that would want to benefit from that, and not enough money in the reserve. 1/80th of 1%. I don't know.
Our consideration has been given to us, of course, and the first year would be the base year, I would assume, so that you'd be able to figure out what in succeeding years you would come up or your needs would be. There has been, I can't say this, and I can't give the exact figures on it either, because we have no way of really knowing, because we have duplicity in, well, I shouldn't say duplicity, we have a duplication in some counties. Marion County, as an example, is combined with Polk County for this service. And if Polk County could supply us with their particular funding needs for one given year, that would be fine. But to go out and say that we know that, say, when Harney or Lake County or something of that nature, that they may not have, they have a small, sparsely populated area. But every one of them, I can't say this, every one of them do have Indigent veterans. And at this time, of course, as I mentioned before, that a considerable amount of money was allocated specifically by Multnomah County in the 34-35 period. But of course, that was during the Depression, but there still was a tremendous amount of money that was allocated by the county.
Mr. Chairman, what if we get here?
Yes, as a matter of fact,
the municipal office will do a breakdown county by county and take one through. That wouldn't be difficult.
No, I don't think it'd be difficult at all. Matter of fact, I think what we'll do is revenue office and Rich Martin, and I think that they could probably get a, I know they've got TCV, the true cash value, on all counties.
Yeah.
So simply taking 1/80th of 1%, assuming that's the maximum. Right, I'd like to have that for the committee.
I might add, Mr. Chairman, that some of the counties, as I stated, also had stated they were, the county sheriff's office had some qualms about having this excess amount of money, but it was based upon the fact that they were going to use, as the chairman so states, the 1/80th of 1% rather than the up to 1/80th. It may take only 1/10th of 1%. See, it would be, so if you find that out, then the following years, I don't know what you, how you come up with an impact that's beyond the first year, because it's, you'd have either excess or you'd come up short. I just don't really know how that would work. But the fact remains that the prime reason that we're concerned about this is that the stipulation is in the ORS, is if the county does not levy the tax, it must be, and it doesn't give any leeway whatsoever. It says it must be paid from the general fund. And counties are not doing it. We're trying to see that it is made more mandatory rather than permissive.
All right. Representative White. This is why it was represented by, this is why it was referred to the House. For the simple reason that as you read the statute itself, it states, if I can recall my language, it states that the tax of up to 1/80th of 1% is authorized to be levied over and above that already authorized. So we're talking about, thank you. We're talking about the 6% limitation, et cetera. So this is where the question came in as to whether it would require a vote of the people.
We would build this in, in other words, built in, kind of submit this budget to people. If it's above that 6% limitation, this is built into the excess. Is that correct?
Okay. Yes. Yes. Theoretically, yes.
Further questions? Representative Hammond?
Besides funeral expenses, the last sickness expenses included in here, has that been in there for many, many years?
The
and what constitutes last sickness expenses? How long does last sickness go back?
The question, of course, Representative, was is to a determination by an investigative body as to whether this is a last sickness, number one. The idea of whether it's been in there very long, it's been in there as far as we know, it's been in ever since the statute became law back in the 1860s or so. But what constitutes that is dependent upon the investigating officer in determining whether there is this. Now that, as I say, also is a secondary thing with this, because we do know since this was implemented and became law that now we have greater funeral and veteran expenses that are taken care of by the federal government. So this is only secondary, but there are some that would fall under this. There'd be some that would be.
That's all. Further questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Paul Thaddeus, representing the DFW.
For the record, my name is Paul Thaddeus. I'm the state adjutant quartermaster for the Veterans of Foreign Wars, director of the legislative affairs for the DFW. I think our legislative spokesman has covered the case well as to what the changes are. Looking around the usefulness of the members of the committee, some of them perhaps have not thought back or have not really considered the basis on which we believe that there is a need for this type of legislation in the first place. So I'd like to direct for just 2 or 3 minutes your thoughts to this. Wish to thank you for allowing us this opportunity, and as Mr. Besky said so expeditiously, since it was entered very late. The membership of the VFW is dedicated to the purpose of helping the fellow veteran, his widow, and his orphan. Because they believe that the veteran's service to his nation was special. It was a contribution to the national interest over and above that required of other citizens during wartime. And it should follow, therefore, that in his time of need, a veteran should be given special consideration by his government. Philosophically, all veteran programs are initiated by a recognition of an obligation to restore the veteran to the status and opportunities he would have enjoyed if he had not entered military service, either voluntarily in times of emergency or through selective service. Federal and state programs are at work in these areas. For instance, the U.S. Veterans Administration is involved in three areas: hospitalization, education training, home loan guarantees. The state of Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is involved primarily in two areas: direct home loans and service work through contact officers and through the veterans organization. But beyond this restoration of the veteran to the mainstream of civilian life, there comes a recognition that the veteran in need was deserving of immediate emergency assistance on a short time basis, while efforts were made to correct the conditions that brought about that need. And this is the Veterans Assistance Program, or as the statute states, the Indigent Veterans Program. Historically, there has been a letdown in concern for the veteran following a cessation of hostilities, followed almost automatically and too often by a cutback in funding for programs. It's because of that fact of life that the Veterans of Foreign Wars is pressing for passage of House Bill 3266, making it mandatory rather than permissive, this Indigent Veterans Fund in each county. Our view is that the Veterans Indigent Program should continue as a special program to help veterans in need for the essentials of life. We don't see it as a substitute for a program of general welfare for the unfortunate or the poor. Rather, we see it as an emergency program for instance, the Vietnam veteran whose check was computerized, delayed, but he still needs that milk and oatmeal for his youngsters. We see it for a Korean vet who is injured on the job, faces a month or two before workman's comp catches up with him. You know, this is too true, too often. We see it as a program for a World War II vet with heart attack, stroke, or nervous breakdown before he can be assimilated into other programs. Perhaps at some time in the future, these will all be considered and cared for immediately. But for now, we believe that the veteran does deserve special concern. And that's what the Veterans Indigent Fund is all about. It offers a little bit above and beyond for those who offered a little above and beyond in their country's service, who fulfilled voluntarily or involuntarily their responsibilities to their nation. Whether the course of action that the nation took was right or wrong doesn't matter. It shouldn't concern us in this respect. The veteran did serve. He did offer three things which can never be replaced. He offered his life, he offered his physical well-being, above all, he offered time out of his life. 2 years out of the life of a 22-year-old, for instance, is a long time. It's something that cannot be replaced. In time of national emergency, we do not ask what must be done. We ask, how do we do it? So now, we feel that we should not ask what must be done. We recognize that. We should ask only, how can we assure that it can be done and that it is done? And the VFW answer to that is that passage of HB 3266 will go far in that assurance. Members of the Veterans of Foreign Wars look to the legislature for compassionate recognition of these facts, and we ask that you do submit a due pass recommendation on this measure. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Are there any copies here? Fine. We'd like to have the copies and the questions by members of the committee. Representative Wilhelm.
On lines 19 and 20, page 2, it says that with other than dishonorable discharge, then that means they would give funds to a person who has BCD. Or a general discharge, is the 208.
Right. Most of the language, and we have nothing against having most of the language in this respect changed to other than dishonorable, or as Mr. Kosmetsky as an amendment to this as it is printed, adding the clemency, because that was not, strictly speaking, most of those were not veterans in the first place.
There has been some discussion on it.
Yeah.
You have no objection to changing it. I couldn't support the bill. I'm not sure I could support it anyway, but I could never support it if it had anything in there other than honorable discharge.
Oh.
Medical being considered honorable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I see no cause to help a person with a BCD, for example.
Well, we are not objecting to the language as it is now.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you, sir. Mr. Edward G. Stack, representing the American Legion.
Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Edward Stack, State Commander of the American Legion, State of Oregon. I live at 1808 Southeast Ankeny, Portland, Oregon. Two gentlemen just prior to my being up here stated very clearly what our aspects are in this and hope that we get this bill passed. I would like to expound just a little bit on the last portion of it, on section 2, starting on line 29 of page 2, stating how the fund is to be dispersed. Several counties in the state of Oregon have taken it upon themselves to decrease the amount of expenses put out by the counties. Most of these counties do have county service officers as such, which tends to lend to the needs of the veteran, such as getting his pension, his compensation, information on his total bill of rights. This man, in most cases, in a lot of the counties in the state, is hired on a part-time basis. This part-time basis also being the basis of his monies that he receives for such work performed. A man that's hired on 4 hours a day and tends to the duties that is expressed for him, further, after he leaves his office, is expected by the county to take on the duties of a man that should be appointed to the office of disbursing the indigent fund. This man then involves himself on spending 2, 3, 4, 5 hours a day for other funds, such as seeking out the advisability of giving an indigent veteran relief fund. It's asking too much of one man to do this, and this is why this portion of this bill is very important that it passes, that the county will set up some way or other a man described to handle this job and dispersing the indigent fund. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stack. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Is there anyone else wishing to appear on House Bill 3266? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bill Latham, and I'm going to speak as a private citizen, Point Forward, Southeast Concord, Milwaukee, Oregon. And I'm here for another reason. Didn't realize the bill was coming up. And I thought I would just give you some of my observations on it. I'm a disabled war veteran out of World War II. I was pretty badly beat up in Palau and had both legs broken up to the knees, and I've got both legs full of silver tin. Now, prior to World War II, well, while I was in the service, I had planned to be into the medical profession. Matter of fact, I was a pharmacist made an operating room technician while I was in the service. And as a result of that injury, I spent 18 months in CAS, and my education was out of a wheelchair in college and on a set of crutches, and I was compelled to go into a business-type training, majoring in accounting and business administration. And up until about 10 years ago, I had steel supports all the way to my knee, and I had been able to do away with this type of thing. And as I sit and listen to what these gentlemen are saying, as I say, I had to give up a medical profession fundamentally because I wasn't able to be on my feet. Unfortunately, I've had to turn around and had some operations. So, but I can see what they're asking for. And as a private citizen who has been subjected to just exactly that type of thing, I would ask it's favorable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to appear on House Bill 3266? If not, that concludes the hearing on the bill. And we'll set that for a work session on Friday. That way I think we'll have opportunity to look at any amendments and the committee will have an opportunity to set it. I'm going to open the hearing right now on Senate Bill 604. And I thought I saw Senator Meeker wondering. Yes, I did. There he is. Senator Meeker, would you like to appear on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record,
I didn't see you. Excuse me, State Ranger Redden, I didn't see you came back there. Protocol being what it is, I know that Senator Meeker will represent your best interest.
I'll be very brief, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tony Meeker. I represent the 15th Senatorial District. The chief sponsor of this bill is Senator Burbidge. And I, at the request of the Oregon State Employees Association, introduced this legislation. The intent of the legislation and people with a much broader expertise than mine on the subject will give you in detail some of the brief points that I will make. But the intent of the legislation is to correct what we think is an arbitrary interpretation of the law on the part of the court. And it refers to a case in 1971, which has been called the Phillips case, and a more recent court case, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, the Jack Thompson case. The section of the law that is suggested to be amended by Senate Bill 604 is on the dismissal of an employee in a classified service. And I point out to you that the current law says that the dismissal has to be proven that you cannot make the dismissal only if an employer has been absolutely arbitrary. And that was the court, I think that's the key word that the court has used, that you cannot reinstate the employee unless you can prove that the employer was arbitrary. If you will look at the language here, you'll find that on page 2, line 23, the board shall not be limited to the finding that the action of the appointing authority was arbitrary. So we're saying that the law is not limited to just that language alone, but we're saying that the board shall seek to do substantial justice in a particular case. And it also is given some discretionary authority on line 25, as you can see the board in its discretion in lieu of affirming the action. One other correction I might point out is that we did remove a comma because there's been some insistence that the legislature do so anytime it can. That's, of course, not important to this bill. The importance of this bill, I believe, Mr. Chairman, is that these two cases are going to be held by the courts as the law. I don't think that any of us, or at least myself and sponsors of this legislation, and those who voted for it in the Senate, substantial number, I can't recall the vote, but it was substantially passed, feel that the law is not adequate, that there should be the particular case review for each circumstance, that we cannot use this hard and fast rule that employers are being arbitrary for dismissal purposes. So I urge that you listen to the testimony of those who are much more expertise on this area than I am, knowing that it has my full-hearted support, because I think it's a necessary change in the law.
Thank you, Senator Meeker. Are there any questions?
Yes.
Representative Yalmar.
What is your weight?
Pardon me?
The weight scale bill has passed in the House, is it over in the Senate?
I believe it's been assigned to the Senate Agriculture Committee.
Further questions pertaining to the bill?
All right. Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chairman, I only reflect that in 1971, I had the pleasure of serving on the House State Senate Affairs Committee. And I think that you have a good committee here. It looks like a good makeup, and I bet you have a delightful
committee. Senator, I might add that we do. And I always like to compliment my committee, not only for the broad cross-section of the philosophy that's displayed here, but for their alertness and awareness of all of the issues facing the state of Oregon today. Thank you.
Thank you.
given that, looking up on State Treasurer Jim Redden, who will probably tell us that he never did serve on state federal affairs.
Matter of fact, Mr. Chairman, I was like chairman of state federal affairs in 1960.
Do you really need this bill again?
No, it's not. It's not a bill for the treasurer. I suggested that I perhaps not testify in favor of it, and it was even a suggestion made that if I wanted it, it might be better to testify against it. Now, this problem in the law came to my attention when I was chairman of PIRB, and we did hand down a ruling whereby the agency had fired the individual, and the law made it seemed to make it clear to us that the Civil Service Commission, which later became PIRB, could modify the sentence, so to speak. And this was quite common in civil service legislation nationwide. The court construed it otherwise in the Phillips case and then construed it otherwise in a more recent case. And this legislation, in effect, would tell the Supreme Court that they should that they will apply the law that presumably has already been on the books. In public service, there has been this tendency to create the safety valve situation where the Civil Service Commission, usually, but in Oregon's case, PIRB, can temper the sentence. So if somebody is fired completely, why PIRB might change that into a 90-day suspension or some other form of punishment if they figure that the punishment meted out does not fit the crime. I had, as I stated, I had always thought that this was the law until two recent court decisions. On this seeking to do substantial justice, that I think is a probably double-edged sword because in one case in particular that I can recall, it was the feeling of the two members of the board at that time that the individual who had in fact been fired richly deserved that fate. But the witnesses who were called to testify on a firing by reason of insubordination, the witnesses called never testified to any insubordination, and so in fact the record was pretty short. But I think in that particular case, substantial justice, everyone seemed to agree, would have been done had the termination been affirmed. So it's not just this language, in my opinion, would not be just a one-way street. And I think it does give the board the authority to do, in fact, substantial justice in these cases.
Thank you, Treasurer Redden. Is there any questions for Jim? How come you never made it to the chairman, or vice chairman of the state federal affairs?
Because the other party took over the next session, and I wasn't able to turn around.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Senator Burbidge.
Mr. Chairman, the political party of which I have been a faithful supporter and member for most of my adult life has controlled the Oregon Senate during my brief tenure there, and I've never been able to make it to state and federal affairs, even as a member. So.
You think a letter of recommendation from this committee would perhaps do you some good?
It might carry a great deal of weight in the next session of the legislature.
We might compose that, depending upon, of course, your behavior here before us today.
Well, I'm certainly going to be on my very best behavior, Mr. Chairman, and with respect to the opening remarks of the previous witness, where he said that it wasn't a bill for the treasurer's office, I submit for consideration to this very august body that might very well have been a change in the law that would have been applicable, had it been applicable, the intent down the corridor on that same floor to the other end of the building a year ago. Maybe this particular piece of legislation wouldn't be here if the intent of this legislation before you were in practice then. Speaking specifically to the ability to do substantial justice. In any industry labor arbitration proceeding or in a proceeding involving a teacher under a fair dismissal law, the arbiter or review board seeks to do justice in that particular case. It's also true in other civil service systems with which we're familiar. Now, that's what we're talking about here in 604, is to do justice, and it states simply that PIRB, on hearing an appeal from a disciplinary action, shall not be limited to finding the action of appointing authority to be arbitrary, but shall seek to do substantial justice in that particular case. That's all the bill is about. It's really a very, very fair bill and a necessary one.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Senator. Are there questions for the Senator? Representative Wilhelm.
You probably should point out that the State Federal Affairs Committee of the Senate operates somewhat differently than the State Federal Affairs Committee of the House of Representatives.
That's what I've been told, Mr. Chairman, that they do operate over there in a unique fashion. Yes, that's true. This committee, much like this bill, is very straightforward. That's not to suggest that perhaps some other committees aren't, but ours is. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kulongowski, representative from Lane County, member of the Judiciary Committee.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ted Kulongowski, and I'm the state representative from District 43. I'll file my disclaimer with the committee at this particular time that we represent the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, which handles a number of matters before the Public Employee Relations Board pursuant to this particular statute. And I'll say it just very briefly, that the problem I think the court has had in all the cases that they've heard under this is they don't know exactly what in the heck that they're trying to determine, and they do not know the role of the Public Employee Relations Board. And in fact, it appears that every case they come out with, they reevaluate and look at differently what the role of the Public Employee Relations Board is in disciplinary matters. And the latest one they had that, well, it isn't the latest, but the one that they, I think, greatly expanded and went into the good faith concept was matter in the Secretary of State's office here. And I think that what has concerned, and it's created a problem in the state's ability, I believe, to properly discipline its employees and terminate them if for some reason that they should be terminated. And that is, I don't think that the agencies know what evidentiary burden that they have to bear in these. I don't think the Public Employee Relations Board understands what their role is. And I don't think the court, looking at the statute, really knows themselves what they are supposed to be telling the administrative agency, this is your function. Now, very interesting, they talked about the Phillips case, and when I first moved to Oregon in 1970 and I was a law clerk down in Eugene, I was the law clerk for the judge that decided the Phillips case out of the circuit court down there. And at that particular time, I remember that Judge Spencer was having a great deal of difficulty with the case because he couldn't find exactly what the role of the court was and what the administrative agency, and it was all filed up. I think that the bill before you is one that I think is very easy for everyone to understand. And what it is there is a definition of just cause. And it's been one that's been built up over the last 35 years in the private sector. And I think that when Tom Enright talks to you, you'll find out that a number of the states and other public employee areas have also adopted the same type of a definition. What we're trying to do is we're trying to tell the states and we're trying to tell the Public Employee Relations Board that this is the standard that you'll use in disciplining employees. And I think that the court would not have any trouble in looking at it and finding out what the Public Employee Relations Board's jurisdiction in determining these matters are. Now, I think that there's a question that always that the employer takes an action and he believes that it's right and he believes that it's just. Should anyone sit in review of that particular decision? And the problem is when you get into the area of good faith and you talk about arbitrariness, and I think that they're all involved in the decision of whether there was just cause for dismissing that person. And that's all we're asking, is that this particular bill set out that is the standard. So if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them if I can.
Mr. Representative Kulongowski, are either you or Mr. Enright prepared to outline to the committee today the difference between good faith and just cause?
Tom has a statement here.
He
does
plan to get into that.
He gave it.
I think it would be helpful to the members of the committee to understand the difference between the two.
Should I tell you this time, I think the whole statute is unconstitutional. I mean, it's a problem. I won't get into that.
We'd rather you didn't raise that question while we're attempting to perhaps amend the statute. Further questions for Representative Kulongowski?
I won't raise that, if you don't want to.
Thank you. No, don't do that. Yes, Representative Dinsmore.
Well, I just want to ask Representative Kulongowski how many votes he thought it took to revise the Constitution and how many amended.
Again, it's funny. I've been talking to Representative Myers about Senate Bill 1.
Thank you, Representative Kulongowski.
See, have I taken care of, yes, okay. I think I'm ready for Mr. Tom Enright. Tom? I understand the Republicans are excused for caucus. Is that true? You both have a caucus too? Or?
Well, I don't know if that happened, but I just
don't. All right, fine. If you make any momentous decisions or need some help, call down here and we can get a vote for you. For a caucus position, if you need a vote for a caucus position, please can get someone up there.
We might need representatives of well-known gentlemen for another problem.
Well, I think you're subject to call up there, aren't you?
Sure.
Get you there.
Okay.
Okay. Jim Wright, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Enright, representing the Oregon State Employees Association, who requested the introduction of this bill. Before going into my own testimony, I'd like to mention the fact that Mr. William Laverty, I think most of you know him as the outstanding management labor lawyer in the state of Oregon, a Republican, president of the Portland Chamber of Commerce, and I don't know how many other things he's done. Anyway, Bill Laverty yesterday by telephone gave me permission to add his endorsement.
Excuse me, could I ask Representative Kulongowski to be a little more quiet? I'm having difficulty hearing you today, Mike.
Mr. Laverty, whom I have just described, gave me permission by telephone yesterday to add his endorsement to this bill. Not only is he an outstanding labor attorney, as I said, but also he's former chairman of the Public Employee Relations Board and has been there through their process. I think he was one of the first members of that board when it was being established and did a very remarkable job in it. I would like to mention also, one of the senators reminded me, because he hadn't remembered to say it, but the vote on this bill was 29-0 in the Senate, so it had strong support from both sides. Probably I can do best by getting into a couple of technical reasons why the court made this unfortunate, as we feel, decision in the Phillips case, and so forth. Since civil service was enacted in the state of Oregon back in 1945, it contained, as all civil service systems do, a review procedure when an employee has been discharged, suspended, demoted, a review procedure and appeal before the Civil Service Commission for that person to have a chance to review and see whether the employer's action was proper. In the year 1969, the Civil Service Commission, as you know, was abolished. The personnel function was put into the executive department as a management function and called a merit system. A lot of question about whether it's properly called. But anyway, it's called a merit system, and then the review or quasi-judicial procedure was put over in the newly created Public Employee Relations Board, which had, among other things, the supervision of collective bargaining, but also review of various things that happened in the state service. Now, as one who worked on the legislation that year with the governor's office, I know that it was certainly contemplated that the and I gave an affidavit to the Supreme Court to this effect a while back on an appeal. It was contemplated that the same review procedure as the civil service system had administered would be continued under the new Public Employee Relations Board. However, there was enacted in the description of duties of the board a section which says that the board shall review any personnel action that is alleged by an affected party or an organization certified by the rules of the board as representing an affected party, to be arbitrary or contrary to law rules, or taken for a political reason, and set aside such action as it finds these allegations to be correct. Now, making the decision in the Phillips case, whoever did the legal research for the judge on that decided that the power of the Public Employee Relations Board to have the discretionary merit power to modify a decision and so forth was limited by this language over here that says review any personnel action alleged to be arbitrary. Well, that was never the purpose of this particular section. When it was talking about review personnel actions alleged to be arbitrary, it was talking about personnel actions other than those covered by the review section that we seek to amend here. But anyway, the court made such a finding, and we were stuck with it in the Phillips case. We came to the legislature in the 1973 session with a bill which went to the House Labor Committee, and the chairman was a member of that committee and may remember that we testified, and I think Treasurer Redden testified, I'm not mistaken, I'm not sure who else, At the conclusion of that testimony, Mr. Durham over here, I don't know if he signed up to testify or not today,
yes,
came on the stand and said that if this bill that we had in the last session, would be the same effect this one, were to pass, the number of appeals from disciplinary actions of employees would swell in a great exaggerated manner. We would have to hire more attorneys to represent the Attorney General's office and so forth and so on. I think the story he and Clay Penwell put on that day managed to create a little bit of panic in the Labor Committee at that time from what they had to say. So it was necessary afterwards for me to go to PERB and the Personnel Division, get statistics on the number of people who are fired or demoted or suspended each year, the number of appeals that are taken, bring that to the chairman of the committee and ask for another hearing. As the chairman will recall, another hearing was held. The House the House Labor Committee gave a due pass to the bill, and it passed the House of Representatives in the 73rd session. However, the tactic that had been employed did effectively kill the bill for that session, because by the time it got to the Senate, it was about the last week of the session, and it didn't pass. I hope in any testimony from the Attorney General's office today that there won't be these attempts at exaggerating, that there would be a tremendous amount of appeals and so forth and so on, because actually, in the state service, there are disciplinary actions taken of the type we're talking about, against less than 100 people per year on an average. I think it's around 80 or something like that. There are certainly many cases for civil service employees being put out of the service. But ordinarily, that's taken care of in their trial service period in the first 6 months. There are also many cases later where the employee is asked to resign and does resign and so forth. So the number of appealable cases comes out to less than 100, and the number of cases that are actually appealed comes out to a small number. Now, I have here a summary of board action on disciplinary appeals during the period between July 1st, 1969 and May 1st, 1975. This was gained from the PERD. The type of action, dismissal, there were 66 appeals during that period of about 5 years. 42 were affirmed. In other words, the Civil Service Commission or the PERB agreed with the agency and said the person should be dismissed. 12 were denied. In other words, they went the other way. And 12 were modified, probably to a suspension. In suspensions, there were 18 cases. 11 were affirmed. And they agreed with the agency. 6 denied, 1 modified. In demotions, there were 3. 1 was affirmed. And 2, they overturned the agency. So in these cases, in case you fear that either the Civil Service Commission or the PERB is going to be keeping all kinds of bad employees on the payroll, the total cases over that period that went to PERB, 87, the agency was agreed with 54 times, it was overturned 20 times, denied 13 times. Don't be fooled by any exaggerated figures that any change in the law that might take place as a result of 604 would do anything to affect the personnel system of the state. What we have sought to do in writing Senate Bill 604, first, of course, we wanted to do very obviously what was mentioned in lines 23-24 to counteract the opinion of the Court of Appeals and say the board shall not be limited to find that the action of the appointing authority was arbitrary, but shall seek to do substantial justice in the particular case. The original language is in and it says on. I don't really know if it makes a great deal of difference. While we were doing it, in order to give, as Ted Kulongoski stated, court better criteria than this in good faith for cause, we adopted the language of just cause. And the reason we've done that, we feel it's compatible with the whole trend towards collective bargaining, that just cause is understood by arbiters. I assume the day is going to come soon when the PERB or some other board will no longer handle these matters like this, but they will be the subject of contract grievance arbitration. However, you have to remember that there are many state employees and classified employees who are not in any bargaining units yet, and you have to have something for them. So it's a mixed bag. But I think when they're all organized, and certainly they will be by various organizations, very likely a statute like this would probably be eliminated and go to arbitration. Under arbitration, the test would be just cause. I want to quote from an article by Robert Howlett. And Robert Howlett is the chairman of, I think it's the Michigan State Public Employee Relations Board, and in a speech in which he was talking about the protections of job security for employees, he said, quote, "The prime elements of job security are seniority, a grievance procedure, including arbitration, and the concept of just cause. Most collective bargaining contracts provide that employees may be discharged only for just cause. Arbitrators have developed just cause as the sine qua non of a collective bargaining contract. This may be the greatest contribution of arbitrators to industrial jurisprudence. As one arbitrator said, just cause basis for consideration of disciplinary action is, absent the clear proviso to the contrary, implied in a modern collective bargaining agreement. I think from that or any number of quotations, and I've given your administrative assistant a copy of this article, you would realize that in organized industry, where there is collective bargaining, the just cause hearing in arbitration, the just cause is the test of the hearing in arbitration. We think it's consistent with collective bargaining that that be established in the state service, rather than this old-fashioned language in good faith for cause. And I think the meanings of that are lost long back in civil service, just as civil service has been lost in the last few years and really doesn't exist in substance, only in form. And we now have the so-called merit systems where the employer dominates the system and says, you'll get what I think you merit. I don't know how many other questions, and I know you've got more things to come yet. If there are questions that you'd like to ask, I'd be glad to attempt to answer them. But I would like to assure you that there's nothing earth-shaking going to happen, no big piles of appeals upon the state. The Attorney General's office won't have to hire another dozen lawyers and so forth and so on. And that the Senate did pass this after due consideration by a vote of 29-0.
Chairman.
Representative
White.
With the effect of passage of this measure, we only have to create a third position at the Office of Secretary of State.
No, that case is be gone.
Further questions? Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you,
Mr. Rosalind?
My name is Ed Rosalind. I'm Supervisor of Employer Relations for the Executive Department Personnel Division. I think that in the comments made by the esteemed representation advocates for the bill prior to my comments have probably been, I have a little argument with some of the things that they're saying. However, I think that some of the testimony that's been given would tend to distort somewhat the picture of what the court cases that were being referenced actually do say. So I think that in the interest of this, I will take the time and reading through the testimony copies of which I've given to you. The Oregon State Employees Association has requested the introduction of Senate Bill 604, which constitutes an approach to reducing the authority of state agencies to discipline and discharge their employees and increase the power of the Public Employee Relations Board to second-guess agency action. The bill is not an improvement within the existing state merit law system law and could do substantial damage to the ability of state agencies to efficiently manage their civil service workforce. This item of legislation should not be seriously considered by the legislature. The Oregon State Merit System is embodied in ORS Chapter 240, the good system which has worked well in the past. The essence of the system is that employees will be selected, promoted, and compensated on the basis of their individual merit, and that after a six-month trial service period, they will obtain certain statutory rights as regular employees. Such employees may only be disciplined or dismissed from state service on certain enumerated statutory grounds and with an ample review procedure by the Public Employee Relations Board to determine whether the state employing agency has acted arbitrarily and unreasonably in its application of the law, which board decision is ultimately appealable to the Oregon court system. ORS 244.05 through 244.15 provides for trial service employees. Each new employee entering state service is given a trial service period of 6 months. Within the first 2 months of an employee's trial service, the state employing agency may only remove the employee from state service with specific permission and approval of the administrator of the personnel division. Thus, all new employees get at least 2 months to show their value, and any time after the first 2 months of trial service and before the completion of the 6 month period, the employing agency may only remove the employee from state service if the trial service indicates that such employee is unwilling or unable to perform his duty satisfactorily, or that his habits and dependability do not merit his continuance in the service. Employees who are not given notice of their removal from state service at least 10 days prior to the completion of the six-month period are automatically given regular employee status. Although ORS 244-10 provides no formal hearing procedure for trial service employees contesting their removal, the Public Employee Relations Board has consistently provided such hearings under ORS 240-086, in which the board is given authority to review any personnel action that is alleged by an affected party or an organization certified by the rules of the board as representing an affected party to be arbitrary or contrary to law or rule, or taken for political reasons, and to set aside such action if it finds these allegations to be correct. The Public Employee Relations Board has specifically provided for appeals from personnel actions, including removals of employees during trial service periods, in their Rule 16-225. ORS 244-15 grants trial service employees regular employee status upon satisfactory completion of the six-month trial service period. Suspension, reduction, demotion, or dismissal of regular employees is statutorily provided for by ORS 245-55. That provision directs the Personnel Division to establish by rule a procedure whereby the state employing agencies may suspend, reduce, demote, or dismiss an employee only for cases of misconduct, inefficiency, incompetence, insubordination, indolence, malfeasance, or other unfitness to render effective service. This section further limits the suspension of any regular employee to a period not exceeding 30 days in any 12-month period. Under ORS 245-60, employees who are disciplined or dismissed under ORS 245-55 have the right of appeal to the Public Employee Relations Board within 10 days after the effective date of the personnel action, and the board must provide a hearing within 30 days as provided by the statute under PERB Rule 16215. Under ORS 245-60, Section 3, if the board finds that the action complained of was taken by the appointing authority for any political, religious, or racial reason, or was an unlawful employment practice relating to age discrimination, the employee shall be reinstated to the position and shall not suffer any loss in pay. Subsection 4 provides that in all other cases, if the board finds that the action was not taken in good case or cause, it shall order the immediate reinstatement and reemployment of the employee in his position without the loss of pay. The board, in lieu of affirming the action, may modify it by directing a suspension without pay for a given period and a subsequent restoration to duty or demotion and classification grade or pay. Either party has provided judicial review under the Administrative Procedures Act to the Court of Appeals and ultimately the Supreme Court of Oregon. Over the years, a substantial body of case law has developed to interpret the meaning of the identified statutory causes of misconduct, inefficiency, incompetence, insubordination, indolence, malfeasance, or other unfitness to render effective service, and in each category, what is or what is not cause. The Court of Appeals in 1971 in the case of Phillips versus the State Board of Higher Education, and again in 1974 in the case of Thompson versus the Secretary of State, clearly delineated what was good faith for cause. On the enumerated statutory grounds, the Thompson case was appealed to the Oregon Supreme Court, which denied review, and that concurred with the Court of Appeal review. In the Phillips and Thompson decisions, the Court of Appeals recognized the need to balance the authority of the state agency to discipline and discharge its employees against the employee's statutory protections under ORS Chapter 240. Both decisions specifically deny the Public Employee Relations Board the right to second-guess the employee agency through a de novo hearing, but limit PERB's responsibility to determining whether the employee agency had acted in good faith, and whether statutory cause existed or whether the employer had acted arbitrarily and unreasonably in the determination of such cause. In short, the court felt that in order to provide the employing agency with sufficient authority to manage the civil service workforce, it should not permit the PERB board to make a de novo second-guess decision, but should hold the employing agency if the agency acted in good faith and sufficient statutory cause existed, so that one could say the agency had not acted arbitrarily and unreasonable. In the Thompson case, the Court of Appeals laid the matter of interpretation of the phrase good faith for cause to rest by adhering to their previous decision in the Phillips case, with a comment. Excuse me. If the board, through its evidentiary hearing, has found facts which support the charges of the employee, it may only modify the disciplinary action taken if it can also find that no reasonable employer would have regarded those facts as sufficient cause for the action. The court further stated that the cause required by ORS 245-60, subparagraph 4, must necessarily be cause not constituting arbitrariness. In order to modify or reverse an agency order dismissing or suspending an employee, the board must, in those cases where good faith is not an issue, find the action is arbitrary either because the employer has failed to establish facts to support the charges on which the action is based, or because though the charges are supported, they constitute no cause upon which a reasonable employer would base the action. The court further noted in its decision that our interpretation does not reduce the board to a rubber stamp with reference to agency action. Employers remain obligated to establish in a hearing before the board or its agents, following reasonable notice, facts that support the charges upon which they base their disciplinary action. The board must still determine whether disciplinary action was taken in good faith and where it was not. Even though facts sufficient to warrant discipline or suspensions may be present, the board can reinstate. Also, we have pointed out above where the board finds that although the charges made were supported by facts, no reasonable employer would regard a sufficient basis for a specific action taken, it remains authorized by the statute to modify or reverse the order. And finally, under ORS 245-60-3, an employee must be reinstated if the board finds the disciplinary action was taken for any political, religious, or racial reason or was an unlawful employment practice. The court referred to the employee's contention by quoting its earlier Phillips decision as follows. To construe ORS 245-60 as employee urges would result in vesting disciplinary power of the various state agencies over their employees in the board, and not the agencies which appoint them. Such a result would undermine their authority and hamper efficient agency administration. With the background of the substantial case history and court decisions involving the interpretation of the present wording of ORS Chapter 240, the Oregon State Employees Association, by Senate Bill 604, seeks to do that which the Court of Appeals felt should not be done, and that is transfer the authority to discipline and discharge employees from their employing agencies to the 5-member, volunteer, part-time citizen public employee relations board. Senate Bill 604 principally seeks to change ORS 245-60 to eliminate the phrase in good faith for cause and to substitute, therefore, the word just cause. Not only is the word just not defined by the amendment, but the PERB board is given complete discretion to second-guess the employing agency by adding language which states the board shall not be limited to finding that the action of the appointing authority was arbitrary, but shall seek to do substantial justice on a particular case. Naturally, the words substantial justice are similarly not defined. Faced with such an amendment, the employing state agencies would be forced to act at their peril and probably would be reluctant to take needed disciplinary or discharge action against employees, lest the cause committed by the employee not be found by the board to be just. Therefore, rather than have substantial justice prevail, inefficiency in state agency management would be incurred. Before the legislature gives any serious consideration to the proposal of the Oregon State Employees Association embodied in Senate Bill 604, it should carefully evaluate what the Court of Appeals has considered in deciding the meaning and the extent of employing agency authority and employee protection under the existing Chapter 240. First, there are some 40,000 employees in more than 1,600 different classifications of employment and state service. Also, there are some 45 salary ranges. The current Public Employee Relations Board and its hearings officer staff have done a commendable job making certain that appointing authority personnel actions are not arbitrarily or unreasonable in any case. And although the PERB board's caseload is far more than the citizen volunteer part-time board should be asked to carry over an extended period of time, the system is working well. As the legislature transfers the essential employee agency authority and responsibility to make decisions on the day-to-day discipline and dismissal for some 40,000 employees, more than 1,600 different classifications of work, skill, and responsibility, the system will collapse of its own weight, and state employing agency management of the civil service workforce will be dealt a blow from which it may never recover. With the advent of the unionization of state employees, the need is for not less management and authority and responsibility, but indeed for considerably more and better management. Employee union organizations have a valued purpose to serve in seeing that state employees are protected in matters of wages, hours, and working conditions. But the management of the human resources cannot be transferred from the employing agency's appointing authority to either the employee labor organization or to a third-party agency like the Public Employee Relations Board. For these reasons, we ask that after due consideration, you reject Senate Bill 604. Chairman, available for any comments. If there are questions on the legal matters, we have Mr. Durham here.
Yes, I'm going to allow Mr. Durham to back cleanup on this bill. Incidentally, gentlemen, state police, I am going to get your bill today. Don't don't worry, as long as I still have one member left, and I'll be here, so we're going to hear it today. I have a question. You don't really think that the PERB board is working well, do you?
Yes, I do.
You really think that they don't have too much of a caseload already?
I think that they have a caseload which exceeds their current staff, yes. Now, I'm not speaking simply of and totally of the disciplinary cases they're in front of.
All the respect that the PERB board has to take up.
Yes.
It's very difficult and time-consuming, isn't it, really, to get a decision out of the PERB board?
I would say that it currently takes considerable time to get a case scheduled and heard and a determination made. Too much time.
Might be wise to transfer that over to the Bureau of Labor and see if we couldn't beef it up over there and just do it with hearings officers. That's just a thought. I don't want a response on that. But that's just a thought. I've thought about that. I just want you to know I have. Governor, know you're appearing here today?
I believe he does, yes.
He supports the position you're taking in opposition to the bill?
So far as I know, Mr. Chairman, yes.
Questions by Committee Representative White?
Is there a system law currently under any kind of official
approval? I don't know of any particular legislative.
Particular reference to society value. And I'm not saying that legislative, I'm
about it. Well, I think around there are certainly elements that are looking at various factors related to merit system law. I think that, of course, so far as any activity here in the state relating to this, no, I don't know of any.
Some of the previous testimony indicated that one of the reasons they wanted to make this change is because in the area of collective bargaining, for example, just cause is understood, and it's understood about all the conditions of just cause. I'm wondering if that's so, if the executive had it cross the executive's mind, or someone perhaps in the personnel divisions a repeal of the merit system, making all that matters of collective bargaining.
I have a personal opinion, of course, having spent some 24 years in the collective bargaining field, that our merit system law, as it now stands, and the collective bargaining process are not necessarily compatible. For certainly the process by which we establish our merit system rules and the other considerations of personnel policy currently within the state do not dovetail very well with the collective bargaining process. And I think that in time, it would be my opinion that the collective bargaining process will certainly erode the merit system substantially. On the other hand, I think that there are some conditions which also must be faced in terms of not only state government, but municipal government, relative to federal funding and the requirements of the federal system for observance of merit systems for establishment of funds.
Recognizing that, then would you subscribe to Mr. Enright's statement that maybe a dismissal should be more appropriately a matter of grievance in a collective bargaining agreement?
Well, certainly the collective bargaining agreement now, currently, to my knowledge, everyone that we have in state service contains a grievance procedure.
Do those end in binding arbitration?
In every instance that I'm aware of, we also do have an arbitration clause providing for resolution of grievances. The process, I believe there's only one or two cases that have been suggested to be presented to arbitration in this process. And I think one of the concerns, one of the fears is that the state system, the merit system, if you will, is probably not that well understood by people who might be available to arbitrate or to act as arbitrators.
What's the definition of a grievance in the current system? Well, I don't know. I suppose that's all over the board, depending on how many agreements you have. The definition of a grievance by the OSDA, for example. All right, then pursuing that, though, in the other grievances, if they went to binding arbitration, just cause is probably established
and if any area of collective bargaining would be the determination by the arbiter, that be how he would establish a finding?
I believe he probably would. I think that this, of course, opens up to a relatively broad area of interpretation. I think certainly less definitive. I think one of my concerns, one of the things that I think that our presentation discusses here, is that management in state government in dealing with personnel actions, disciplinary and action suspension and so on, probably are somewhat reluctant, even under the current ORS 240 provisions, to take action because of the necessity to conform to a rather rigid system of application. In the case of developing facts against the condition, what is malfeasance? And how do you interpret a factual situation to properly or appropriately relate to a condition of malfeasance? This type of thing. Now, I think that this tends to impose a constriction or a constraint on the management's willingness to readily take action where perhaps action is deserved. And I think that this is one of the constraints that we are concerned with in seeing this bill pass, is that by going to a more broad, a greater degree of flexibility in second-guessing the agency, that now the administrator is going to be further limited in his desire or his willingness to take action because he's so doubtful as to what are the considerations that are going to be observed by a board to approve of that.
That's true, and other actions by the state an action that might result in a grievance that wouldn't follow the statutory process, but it might go to an arbiter?
I think this is relatively true, yes.
A reluctance by the state.
That's right, because again, and I speak, this is a personal opinion, perhaps I should be somewhat restrained in what I say in this regard, but in government, I don't believe that you have strong management, you have administrators. And that the management aspect then becomes diluted when it comes to consideration of personnel management or taking action that you might otherwise find being taken in an industrial setting, for example.
Glad you brought that up, because I think that's also my personal opinion, and I think it oftentimes reflects back, unfortunately, on the other employees and the fact that we have people who administrate rather than people who affect our effective management. That does bother me. Further questions? Representative White.
General, I guess. It just seems to me that it's one purpose of collective bargaining for it to suggest that when it's all included that our consideration, I think the time will come when we can eliminate their allowance at the end of the negotiation. Sorry, I didn't see you were.
That was a previous question, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman, Representative West, certainly my feeling would be that the system will force itself in that direction, regardless of the desires of the party.
Further
questions?
Wait,
Bob.
I agree with
that. I think it's inevitable, because you do tend to have the cause and effect factors that seek resolution, and the collective bargaining process, of course, is the process that establishes the resolution. Ultimately, something's got to give, and if there is enough determination on one of the parties to establish a certain position, I'm sure it will occur in time, in some manner.
Now, the point, Representative Wyatt, that I was driving at, I suppose, if it seems inconsistent, if part of the current agreement between the state and its employees includes a grievance procedure that ends in binding arbitration, and instead of for the finder, that being the arbitrator, being just cause, in this respect, we don't have just cause, and dismissal, it seems inconsistent between one thing and we don't do another. And I suppose ultimately it will be resolved, whether we resolve it here today. Further questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Durham, lie on last, you get the back cleanup. That's a certain advantage to that. It's not very rare.
I left my bat in the office. It had covered most of the ground that I felt might have to be covered. I think it's, for the record, I'm Jim Durham, the deputy general. Prior to the present staff member we had, I did
did the labor work for the state until it got to the point where it became a full-time job, and I had to step out and miss an awful lot of fun and second-guess positions. But I think there's a real misconception in the way in which the Thompson case and the Phillips case have been characterized. Both of them, the court makes it very, very clear that any unreasonable action is subject to being reversed or modified by PERB, which ought to be the case. State agency administrator, the employer, is required to take reasonable action under the circumstances. But you've got to appreciate that on any given set of facts, there's a wide latitude in terms of the action that may be dictated by the events that led up to the need to take some form of disciplinary action. Those factors may be length of service, the amount of counseling, the effort that the employer took, which I just characterize as good management. I think when you get right down to it, what action is actually taken, whether you're talking about dismissal, suspension for 60 days, or demotion, or whatever the case may be, you're trying to tailor the action. And the administrator is trying to tailor that action to the facts of that particular case. This bill, I was joking with Jim Redden that it's kind of a consolation round bill. If you're a loser the first time, you win the loser's bracket, you've got another shot at winning again. And as long as you're in a position where you're able to go ahead and better your position, I think the inclination is to go ahead and give it a try. PERB would tend to go ahead and try to, you know, take a look at it, review everything all over again. And it doesn't get too bad, except that if the administrator goes ahead and gets his courage up, and a lot of them don't have the courage. You hear all the time the civil service system, the merit system, just doesn't allow you to deal effectively with problem employees, and that's not true. Don't let anybody tell you it's true. The administrator's not able to deal effectively with it. He's just not the kind of manager that's necessary. He's the kind of guy that lets them grind away at him until finally something snaps the camel's back in your hand, or get yourself a demotion. You won't face up to dealing with a problem as it builds and trying to correct it, which we're obligated to do. The administrators have taken corrective action, counseling, the whole bit, and trying to resolve it. Where those actions have been taken in a disciplinary manner, we've been able to make it stick. But those kinds, I think, are in a minority in state government. They are not managed. They're working the system. So I think there's been a definite increase in many of the administrators' tendency to go ahead and take effective action. And where you've got a bad employee, I know in my own organization, one of the issues over a stormy bargaining career between our office and Tom's organization, one of the issues I demanded was their responsibility in dealing with the people they represented if I had a problem with models. I expected something from them, because any of you that have any, I'm kind of a management cast out in the context that all unions aren't bad. You've got a good working relationship with a labor organization. It can be as effective a management tool as a good foreman, because their people may have more credibility with the problem than you do. So it all depends on the situation. And if you start working toward effective management, and all of a sudden you get back into a situation where you've got somebody that's going to second guess them, and the answer is going to be, well, yes, what you did was within the boundaries that the law permits, but we would have done something else. And that's really all you're talking about, is permitting PERB to go ahead and substitute their judgment within a boundary. And the Thompson case and the Phillips case say that if the decision is outside those boundaries, you can change it and modify it. But if it's within the boundaries of reasonableness, that all the board can do is affirm the action of the administrator. And I don't think that's an unreasonable position to have state government or any other employer do. I think any indication that it permits unreasonable action just isn't justified. We would support the executive department and governor's position on this at the full game, so I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions by members of the committee?
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else wishing to share on Senate Bill 604? Concludes the hearing on Senate Bill 4. And I'll tell you what, Senate Bill 947.
Mr. Chairman, to speed up maybe other...
Oh, certainly. I was going to suggest
we'll
to
be out of here shortly.
Both Mr. Dougherty and Mr. Comeback. All right.
For the record, my name is Gene Doherty. I'm a captain of the Oregon State Police, and I currently command the Criminal Division. gentleman to my right is Mr. Pete Meany, also in the department, and he is the director of our planning and research group. Senate Bill 947 provides statutory authority for the governor to appoint a committee advisory to the state police superintendent on the operation of the statewide forensic laboratory system. The advisory board is to be made up of a wide spectrum of expertise from not only criminal justice agencies, but also includes a member from the state bar, a public member, and a science administrator from higher education. This group will provide continuing information concerning effectiveness of the operation, user satisfaction, and responsiveness to criminal justice agency needs. The state police are presently constructing in Portland a crime detection facility, which will, in conjunction with the satellite laboratories in Eugene, Medford, and Pendleton, offer laboratory services quicker and more effectively to all user agencies. I might say that this is under LEA funding. We asked for Attorney General opinion on the whether or not the governor had the authority to appoint the advisory board. Executive order suggested by the Attorney General that be done statutorily, the reason for this bill. Also, in the plans of the department with federal funding in 1976, we plan on opening two more satellite laboratories to further offer this service to police agencies. One will be over in the Ontario area, and the other will be in the Coos Bay North Bend area.
What is the anticipated fiscal impact,
Mr. Meany?
Okay, Mr. Meany. Approximately $200 a year.
Is that all?
Yeah.
How often are these fellows going to use?
Probably about four times a year.
They have to brown bag it, do they, on their trip over?
Not getting much. Most of the people are public employees. And whatever it costs will be for 2 years will be out of the federal grant, federal funds.
It'll be out of the anticipated out of the LEA.
Representing Dinsmore, Representing
Gilmore. I just want to point out that I'm sure the law enforcement council has approved the funding, as I recall.
That's true. You're on the council.
Correct.
You're on the new council.
During his tenure, it was at that.
Yeah, my long career on the law enforcement council from November to whenever it was that I got my things closed.
You'll note the makeup of the committee is like the Portland Police Chief, Multnomah County Sheriff, Metropolitan Public Defender, which is Multnomah County. State Medical Examiner is also located in Multnomah County. The presiding judge of the Circuit Court is Multnomah County. And a circuit court from outside, of course, would be the state judge. But basically, a number of these people are located in the metropolitan area, hence the smallness of the fiscal impact.
I would like to point to the chairman one more thing, Mr. Meany. The formation of the advisory board is basically a recommendation of a study commission, crime laboratory study commission conducted up in the Craig area in 73 and 74. It was one of their 12 recommendations. The law enforcement council attached the formation of the advisory committee, advisory board rather, as a special condition to our federal funds.
Representative Gilmore, you had a question?
Just for clarification on page 2, line 26, the police, chief of police will not say Fort Wayne City or county or...
Yes, sir, that would be a chief of police of a city.
Okay. Within the state of Oregon?
Yes, within the state of Oregon, yes.
Would that be made from the Russian Congressional District at all?
I think there's a good chance of that.
Thank you.
I think there's a good chance.
It has, the committee has a pretty wide spectrum of expertise, I think.
Yeah. It'll probably either someone from the 2nd or the 4th representative.
Oh, all right.
2nd or 4th district, I'm not sure which. Representative Wilhelms, did you have a question?
No.
You had your hand up once and you saw
all the
ladies
with all
home. Good to see you back. Further questions? Thank you. Okay, you have a motion? Thank you. Now, if you move the table,
great. Well, I, Mr. Chairman, I noticed Representative Wyatt, who was usually the out motion here, is not present. Main table
oh,
here,
I have motion here.
Well, I have enough time.
Yeah,
enough signals from that side of the table.
Okay.
This side of the table can change when moved by Senate Bill and Gross 947 to the floor. Two pass.
Thank you. Representative Gilmore, move Senate Bill 947. Or the due pass recommendation or the A growth in Bill 947. Or the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
President
Gilmore?
Aye. President
Gilmore? Aye.
President
Hammond? Aye.
President Simpson?
Aye.
President Gilmore?
Aye.
Aye, motion passed.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, I'm paid to wait.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Who do you want to carry there? Do you want to carry there, or do you want Representative Stan Moore, since he's a non-voter on the law enforcement council? All right, Representative.
I don't want to put on the calendar and then.
Yeah. See how it goes? All right, you can explain it, but I just thought it might be nice since you don't get to vote anymore. I mean, I'd at least give you one slot at it this year. First, before we do that, I've got a bill that the speaker asked that we introduce. Where in the world is it? And I think it's rather late, but
is it an amendment or a revision?
Substitute for combustible material, a specific enumeration and definitions of materials with burning and subject permit requirements for open burning and fuel burning under ORS 476-380-478-960.
Question.
You're suggesting we introduce?
No, I have a question.
Question, yes. Sir.
My question is, in all sincerity, is there a particular reason why this went to our committee for a possible introduction other than the rules committee or the fuel burning committee?
I have no answer except that I think that he probably felt that it ought to be introduced right away and we're meeting today, and so here it is and we're ready to introduce it. I have no idea where the bill is going to go once it's introduced.
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't quite able to get all of these. Would you read it in summary again?
Substitutes for combustible material, a specific enumeration and definition of material is burning and subject to permit requirements for open burning and fuel burning under ORS 476-380 and 478-960.
Well, I don't understand it.
I don't either.
Well, because I don't have those ORS.
I have a copy of the bill if anybody wants to look at it.
Unless those ORS is decided in there, I still wouldn't know what the bill is.
I think it has to do with the county.
With what?
Domestic waste. Okay, the definitions, apparently they're attempting to enumerate commercial waste, demolition material, domestic waste, industrial waste, land clearing debris, open burning. But basically, I think what it's doing is defining those where before they had not been defined. And the real change is here on page 3. No person outside, this is current statute, no person outside the boundaries of rural fire protection district or a state forest protection district shall, and then it used to say set on fire, cause to be set on fire any combustible material, either on his own or other property of another, and deletes that, did insert cause or permit to be initiated or maintained on his property, or cause to be initiated or maintained on the property of another, any open burning of commercial waste, demolition material, domestic waste, industrial waste, and land clearing debris without first securing a permit from the county court. In other words, what it's doing, where it was general before, it now becomes specific, and that's what it appears to do in the bill. And as I said, it was a question from the speaker to introduce the bill.
Okay.
Representative Dinsmore, you move the introduction, you do not? Yes, I'm going to need 4 votes, and
for what?
It's going to be embarrassing when I have to go upstairs and say I couldn't have 4 votes.
For what?
For introduction of the bill.
No more embarrassing than having 31 and thinking you passed the bill.
Well, the bill.
Now, wait a minute. Now, what? Oh, I see. All right.
Just for an informal hour.
Representative Wyatt moved that we introduce. Representative Henson, would you make a motion for introduction of this bill?
Asking. You want Matt?
I was just asking you for Matt. Are we informal?
We're informal. This is informal.
What does it do?
Nobody may burn anything combustible.
Without a permit.
It specifies commercial waste, various things.
Barbecue.
Without getting a DEQ permit.
What is chimney?
Without getting a DEQ permit.
If it's got a chimney on your barbecue, you can do it without a permit.
Well, look at how we're doing the bill like this. It says you've got to get a permit from the county board or the board of county.
The speaker asked if I would introduce this bill, or the committee would introduce the bill, and I brought the bill down to be introduced.
Well,
If we don't get it in this committee, can we rescind our approval for introduction?
Based on the time that Pete Willard is in.
What's the reservation on?
I just want to.
I'm not sure there's a reservation on the bill. I think the reservation by Representative Dinsmore is an interpretation of whether you have four votes or you have 31 votes. I think he's referring to some action that possibly occurred on the floor today, but I'm not sure.
Can't the speaker introduce the bill without having to look at it?
That's right.
Right.